Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
What did the New York Times say on the brink of fascism? Today's paper, on the brink of fascism. Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation.
There are other examples of Germany's dark history reverberating today. Take the case of German authorities considering legal action against a publisher there that wants to sell Adolf Hitler's book, Mein Kampf. It was first published in 1925, and it contains Hitler's blueprint for German domination of Europe. It's also violently anti-Semitic.
Mein Kampf was taken off the market right after World War II.
Reporter Daniel Gross has been following the story.
The main anxiety was just, what if this kind of regime could come back? And this was actually done partly with American influence. Americans wanted to take all the Nazi symbols out of Germany and make Germans feel that they were responsible for the acts that had happened there in Germany. And so they took the copyright, which belonged to Hitler and then reverted to Germany when he died. And they just said, you know, we're the only ones who can publish anything and we're not going to, so nobody will get a copy.
So the copyright on Mein Kampf ran out last year and a new version has been republished. What's going on with this version?
So the first version that came out was scholarly. It was 12 pounds and it had 3,700 footnotes in it. So this is something that only a very dedicated scholar would be interested in. But the cause for concern is a right-wing publisher called Der Schelm has released an edition that has no scholarly commentary.
Tell us more about this company, Der Schelm. What are they trying to do with this?
Yeah, I mean, Der Schelm is pretty blatantly right-wing. You could probably say that this is a neo-Nazi press. Der Schelm means prankster, by the way, in German. Mm. So it's sort of a provocative organization. And their edition is really supposed to be supportive of Hitler. I think it's masquerading as a historical text, but I don't think that fools anybody.
So how do they get around the anti-Nazi propaganda laws?
They haven't yet. That's sort of yet to be seen. There are lawyers who are considering suing the company, and their argument will probably be that this is either incitement or this is Nazi propaganda.
So 70 years after World War II, I mean, is anybody in Germany saying now it's kind of paternalistic for authorities to try and control ideas? I mean, it's like they can't trust their own people.
It is. It's a fairly German attitude to feel that anxiety with that intense memory of World War II. But I did speak to, for example, a friend of mine who goes to anti-fascist rallies in Berlin quite a lot. He didn't have any concern about this original edition. And I don't think the anxiety is there for historians. I mean, historians are saying we need these texts to understand what happened in the 20th century. But a lot of the reporting around this has been kind of scaremongering. I think that journalists have reported on this as if the very publication of Mein Kampf or the interest in Mein Kampf is a sign that we're lurching to the right in Europe. And I don't really think that's the case. I think it's not so much about whether the book is being read, but how the book is being read. Is it being read with a critical eye that empowers people to maybe resist ideas like this in the future.
I mean, interestingly, in other parts of the world, like Britain and here in the United States, you can buy Mein Kampf, and it is read, and it is studied. Annotations are not.
Yeah, and it's in the public library in many places in the United States. And I think we know from the American experience that banning a book often creates an obsessive interest in it. And I think that, you know, some historians have argued that's what happened in Germany, that 70 years of not being able to get this book, unless you maybe browsed online where you can get it, generated this interest in it that pushed it to the top of the bestseller list when it did come out.
It really feels like Germany is still wrestling with the whole idea of Nazi propaganda, Nazi thought. Is that coming to a rest, you think, with this expiration of this copyright?
It's hard to say if that attitude will go away. I mean, Germany is absolutely still wrestling with World War II. And it's an interesting moment because, you know, the generation that would have seen Hitler speak and remembers this is dying off. And we're really at the end of that moment when it's a personal story. And now Germans have to decide what part of the history they want to inherit.
Journalist Daniel Gross, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation? All these people from Syria coming up in here. People from Iraq. And it's some of them from the other side of the Mediterranean, sure enough. Now, we let as many as we could drown, but there's still some. And they're coming up in here.
Big international story, isn't it? Britons are waking up this morning and heading to the polls to vote in a referendum on whether or not to remain a part of the EU. Professor Denny Bradlow, who's a professor of international development law and African economic relations, good morning to you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And of course, you are from the University of Pretoria, the law faculty. Why should we care about Brexit?
Well, we should care about Brexit for a number of reasons. One is that the UK is an important trading partner, an investment partner for South Africa. But also the EU is our most important trading partner, and what happens in the election will affect the EU as much as it affects Britain as well. So if the vote is to leave, then certainly it will affect our relations with both Europe and with the UK.
Mm-hmm. So there's just no way that that Brexit could have no economic repercussions for the South African economy?
There's no way that it could. I mean, if the vote is to leave, because it, in the short run, it will have an effect on financial markets. It will affect the sterling, which will have an impact on us. It will cause a lot of uncertainty, and it will affect money flowing into or out of South Africa. And in the longer term, it will have an effect on trade relations. If the vote is to remain, it could have an opposite effect. I suppose there would be an immediate vote move towards confidence. We've seen, as the polls have indicated, that remain seems more likely. Markets have reacted favorably. But that's a short-term thing. Over the long term, even a remain vote could have an impact on us.
Okay, that's very interesting. And then I'm also watching international news networks, Professor Bradlow, and hearing what what citizens are saying. Ordinary citizens are being stopped in the street to express their views and all of that. And it's been very interesting to me how those who are against staying, those who want to vote yes, let's exit, they're raising things like immigration and how Britain is such a great nation. So it's mainly like a sense that our nationhood, as it were, is being diluted or being threatened by being in the EU. We can stand on our own. I didn't get a sense that there were considerations for the economic implications. So how much of that is at play here, the nationalism aspect?
One of the interesting things about the whole campaign is that the people in favor of leaving, as you say, are worried about immigration, which is not really a European issue so much as a sense of their own nationhood. But the Remain campaign haven't been talking about the European Union either. They're talking about how terrible the economic consequences will be of leaving. And part of the reason for that, I think, is because the EU is so unpopular to both sides. So it's the people who voting Remain are saying it's there are problems with the EU, but we think we're better off in than out. Whereas the exit people are saying things are so bad, we don't trust our elite anymore. We don't feel that we're taken seriously. We want a change. And that's so a lot of the vote against. Mm. Another part is the nasty side of the immigration issue and really a racism that's behind that as well.
Brexit, Britain leaving the European Union. You know what happened. The issue got hijacked by a bunch of anti-immigration isolationists who were obsessed with the idea that foreigners were stealing their jobs. Thank God something like that could never happen here.
Well, the Brexit vote was fueled in part by nationalism and fear of immigration, and that sounds familiar to a lot of people in this country. This morning, Donald Trump was in Scotland promoting one of his golf courses. He spent most of his press conference talking up his business, not Brexit, but eventually he did address the vote.
I really do see a parallel between what's happening in the United States and what's happening here. People want to see borders. They don't necessarily want people pouring into their country.
And later this afternoon, President Obama said he spoke with British Prime Minister David Cameron, who he said is committed to an orderly transition out of the EU. Obama spoke at a global entrepreneurship summit in California.
I do think that yesterday's vote speaks to the ongoing changes and challenges that are raised by globalization. But while the UK's relationship with the EU will change, one thing that will not change is the special relationship that exists between our two nations. That will endure.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. And Scott, a lot of people thought Trump was wrong to leave the campaign trail for what was supposed to be a business trip. But actually, the timing looks pretty good right now. He's in total control of the news cycle.
Well, that's right. And he, in some ways, there's going to be some criticism of him standing on his golf course and saying a drop in the British pound is good for tourism business here at my golf resort. But certainly, a lot of folks are going to be drawing parallels between his campaign and the successful exit campaign in the UK.
Yeah, you've got to wonder. I mean, the vote, if it would give him some sort of momentum, because it was a validation of the fears that his campaign has been hitting on in this country.
Yeah, I don't think it gives momentum in the sense that someone who was against Donald Trump in this country is now suddenly going to say, you know, maybe I ought to give him a second look. Hmm. But certainly what it will do is say that the kind of nativist frustrations that he has capitalized on in this country are serious, they are widespread, and that establishment politicians like London bookmakers minimize those feelings at their peril.
Hmm. You got Hillary Clinton as well in a statement this morning saying that this is a time of uncertainty. It underscores the need for calm, steady, experienced leadership. Are we hearing anything else from Clinton today?
Hillary Clinton's campaign just did a conference call with reporters, and it was one of those conference calls where the questions may have been more telling than the answers. Reporters were peppering the campaign about similarities between Clinton campaign messages and the messages of the unsuccessful Stay campaign in the UK. Even the slogan, like Better Together, there's a real echo between what the unsuccessful Stay campaign in the UK was arguing and the arguments that Hillary Clinton's been making in this country. Now, it's not really just about, you know, the slogans. It's really about the underlying philosophy. Hillary Clinton believes that countries are strongest when they work together. She believes that was true of the UK. She believes that was true of the United States. President Obama made that same argument when he campaigned for the Stay campaign back in April. He said the UK magnifies its influence when it works with the EU. He believes that Donald Trump and his supporters don't believe in that sort of internationalism. They're more of a sort of every country in its own is out for its own self. And That's a real fundamental difference, and certainly in the UK vote, it shows that every country on its own has a strong following.
It is fascinating. I mean, the parallels between what Donald Trump has been saying, his nationalist conversations, the fear of immigration. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton representing this sort of status quo in the leadership. I think that's important to watch. But the stock markets across the globe are reacting to this, including here in this country. if the United States economy starts going south after the Brexit, who does that benefit or hurt more in the race for president?
Well, Peter, I have to say, if I were a really good forecaster, I would have sold my stocks yesterday. So I'm not take this with a big grain of salt. The simple conclusion is that a struggling U.S. economy is tough for the Democrats. Hillary Clinton is running to as a more of a stay the course type candidate than Donald Trump is. So in theory, the stronger the U.S. economy is, the better it is for Hillary Clinton. The weaker the U.S. economy is, the better it is for Donald Trump. It's possible, though, if you take a sort of second level analysis, that voters might say, well, it was Donald Trump type thinking that caused all this turmoil, and maybe we don't want to go that direction. But I think the simple explanation is usually the one that's more accurate.
So do you see the Clinton camp sort of preparing its own reaction to this?
Well, Hillary Clinton gave a speech earlier this week. It was a speech that was not about saying, hey, aren't you doing great? Let's stay the course. It was a speech about saying, I understand that there are inadequacies with the economy. I understand that a lot of people are frustrated with their economic situation, but I have better economic prescriptions than Donald Trump does. That was the argument she was making even before the UK vote. I think she's going to be probably polishing those arguments and trying to improve them going forward.
Yeah, well, then there was Bernie Sanders, who has drifted to the sidelines a little bit today, saying that he would vote for Hillary Clinton in November. He said he understood that the economy was not working for everybody in the United States, and it's also not working for everybody in the UK. Interesting, he says he will vote for Hillary Clinton, but still in a way drawing his own distinctions with Hillary Clinton. All right, we'll keep an eye on that. Scott Horsley, White House correspondent for NPR. Thank you.
Good to be with you on this tumultuous day.
Absolutely.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. And now, a word from the president.
This presidential election comes on the heels of a year of incredible black activism in the streets, on college campuses, and at campaign rallies. You might expect that political energy to be reflected at the ballot box, but as NPR's Asma Khalid reports, some young activists don't see much point in voting for president.
When Koya Graham turned 18, the first thing she did was register to vote. And she was a loyal voter until this primary season.
I'm not interested anymore. I don't see any immediate significant changes happening.
Graham is in her 30s now, and she no longer sees voting as a means to an end.
And I know people use the argument, well, black people have, you know, fought so hard to get the right to vote, and then how can you not vote? I understand your point, but we vote these people in the office, and then once they get in the office, then what?
Part of her frustration is that she says black lives have not improved under the country's first black president. She points to the repeated shooting of unarmed black men. She doesn't necessarily blame President Obama, but she says she now realizes the presidency is limited in its power.
For me to have so much faith in him coming in, thinking that he was going to make a change, and that was his big, that was his big word. That was his word, change. And yes, we can, and yes, we will, and we have not.
These days, Graham is focusing on grassroots activism. She's a community leader working to empower and educate black people in Cleveland, her hometown. Cleveland is a city that's witnessed police-involved shootings firsthand. The most notorious incident was Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old boy shot while playing with a toy gun. For Kelton Latson, it's a shooting that's hard to forget. Latson is 24, a student at Cleveland State. And for him, the question of voting is a little more complicated. He did vote in the primaries, but only for down-ballot races.
So I believe in voting for, like community struggles, like councilmen, mayors, like local stuff, mainly because that right there firsthand affects you the most.
But even on a local level, he's not sure politicians are talking about the real concerns of black people, who suffer from the highest unemployment rate and the shortest lifespans.
It's a lot of problems that I feel within the black community that can only be solved by us, and that's politics is not going to fix any of that.
So Latson makes a point of regularly visiting the juvenile detention facility to talk to black kids. Both Latson and Graham have no intention of voting for president this November. Their decision is less a referendum on Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump than a referendum on voting. This is by no means to say that African Americans as a whole are going to skip out on November. Millions have already voted in the Democratic primary. But some are making a conscientious objection.
They may think at this stage in their lives that it's best for people to work outside of the political process because of their perception that Washington is broken.
Andra Gillespie is a professor at Emory University in Atlanta who focuses on race and political mobilization. Gillespie points out that even if some young folks skip out on voting, they still are involved in politics.
I think, you know, we would be remiss to not acknowledge the importance of Black Lives Matter in making criminal justice reform an issue that candidates have to address.
But Gillespie warns that just as the presidency has its limits, politics with no voting has its limits too. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
You're not an American. You are the victim of America. You didn't have a choice coming over here. He didn't say, black man, black woman, come on over and help me build America. He said, nigga, get down in the bottom of that boat and I'm taking you over there to help me build America. Being born here does not make you an American. I'm not an American, you're not an American. You're one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of America.
A campaign sign in Polk County is gaining a lot of attention for its words, make America white again. Thank you for joining us. I'm Cindy Sexton.
And I'm David Carroll. The sign was paid for by Rick Tyler, an independent candidate for Tennessee's 3rd District Congressional seat, a seat currently held by Chuck Fleischmann. Now, the sign has been taken down, but not by the congressional candidate. New at 5, the candidate tells Channel 3 Eyewitness News reporter Kelly McCarthy the reason behind the message. Kelly?
David, the billboard was taken down less than 12 hours after being put up. But that was enough time to catch the public's attention and cause some controversy. But tonight, congressional candidate Rick Tyler says he stands by his decision to create the billboard that says, Make America White Again.
As far as the putting up of a billboard like this, you know, this is First Amendment 101.
It didn't take long for the billboard saying Make America White Again along Highway 411 in Polk County to get people talking, which is exactly what congressional candidate Rick Tyler wanted.
I was expecting it to do exactly what it has done. I was expecting it to go viral, to spread far and wide.
And it has. Pictures of the billboard have been shared thousands of times, but not always because they agree with him.
If I see a sign that say, you know, make America white again, it offends me also, you know, much less people of other ethnicities and different colors, you know, they're especially offended probably.
I believe in an integrated America. I have lots of friends who are different races and nationalities, and I love them to death.
The plaza where the billboard used to be displayed is now generating a lot of traffic.
Just wanted to see it and take a picture of it and hoping I could actually meet him.
But for many people, the message is not welcome.
We love our people and our customers, so please don't think that is any way associated with us.
Rick Tyler says the message is referring to the 1960s era, a time he believes was a better America and more predominantly white. Tyler says the comment is not meant to be racist.
As far as things being offensive, hey, get over it. The world is offensive. There are things that offend me.
The billboard is down, but the owner will not confirm why. Tyler hopes it goes back up soon.
If I could, I'd have hundreds of these billboards up all over the 3rd District.
Tyler says he paid to have several billboards up around the 3rd Congressional District until after the November election. It's not clear how many of those billboards have been taken down, but Tyler says he's looking into that issue. Live in the studio, Kelly McCarthy, Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
I think this country was built on gangs. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this country still is run on gangs. Republicans, Democrats, the police department, the FBI, the CIA, those are gangs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The correctional officers. Mm-hmm. I had a correctional officer tell me straight up, we the biggest gang in New York State. Straight up.
A federal investigation in New York City is revealing a culture of backscratching and outright corruption at the highest levels of the NYPD. Federal prosecutors announced charges today against senior police officials and others, including a political contributor to the mayor. Here to talk about this big ongoing investigation is WNYC reporter Robert Lewis. And Robert, to start, we know upwards of 4 police officials were charged today. What happened?
Well, there was a sergeant in the gun licensing division of the NYPD who apparently accepted bribes in exchange for fast-tracking pistol licenses. There was a police officer in the same unit who already pleaded guilty to the alleged scheme. And the man who paid the bribes, who runs a Orthodox Jewish security patrol, he's also been charged in that scheme.
And the others?
Well, two of the highest-ranking officers in the department, a deputy chief and a deputy inspector, they allegedly got expensive gifts, trips, even prostitutes from a politically connected businessman who in return got favors from these cops. This is actually U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara talking about the case, announcing the charges.
They got, in effect, a private police force for themselves and their friends. Effectively, they got cops on call.
Now, this is part of a larger investigation. How do these arrests tie into that?
Well, when news first broke in April, there was this multi-tentacled probe, and these cases sort of start to fill in the blanks and show how they're connected. There's a Ponzi scheme up in Harlem. There's this gun licensing probe. Just earlier this month, the head of the jail guard union was arrested and charged with corruption. And many of these cases involve these same businessmen sort of using their money to get favors and influence with officials.
Now, how significant is this for the NYPD?
Well, it seems to be a pretty big deal. We've already seen close to a dozen high-ranking NYPD officials either put on modified duty or having left the department as part of this probe. And every 20 years, there really seems to be some sort of major corruption scandal in the NYPD, and we're pretty much at that 20-year mark. Worth noting, Commissioner William Bratton sort of downplayed the notion that there's something deeper, bigger going on. He said that this isn't like those past probes, corruption investigations. This is just an issue with a few individuals.
Police officers, especially high-ranking members of the department, have to know better, need to know better, and have to set the example for others and have to follow the law.
In the charging documents, there are allegations that even lower-level officers sort of knew about what was going on. They were, you know, maybe pulling over someone on a parking ticket and knew that, oh, wait, this is a friend of the deputy chief, so maybe we should let them off. So I think there are some serious questions about how deep this went.
Before I let you go, what can you tell us about any connection there can be to the mayor's office?
The businessman who was paying these alleged bribes or giving gifts to these high-ranking police officials, one of them was Jeremy Reichberg. He's a fundraiser to the mayor. Certainly there's been a lot of chatter that these probes are looking at donors to the mayor. That being said, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara was very clear in today's press conference saying that this case does not connect directly to the mayor's office.
That's Robert Lewis from WNYC. Thank you for sharing your reporting. Come by my palace.
We don't need no. And last thing on the Persian girl from McKinney, white people are going out of their way to say, oh, actually, I think she was assaulted. I think she was abused. I think that she was manhandled. They know that there is a sexual term for that, and that man would be called a fatue, and it's something you do because I looked at him. He rubbed up against that little girl. He got comfortable. You could feel him settling off into it. It was nothing but a pedophilic sexual act, and it was absolutely obscene, and no one's saying that.
A grand jury in Texas has decided not to indict a former cop from McKinney, Texas, by the name of Eric Casebolt. Apparently, he was the cop in question when there were accusations of police brutality during a fight at a pool party. Now, the fight was between two adult females, both of which were white, but Officer Casebolt showed up. So the grand jury decided that there was not enough evidence to indict him.
And by the way, he dropped like he left something there. He dropped like his nightstick or something because another cop came.
Who needs a nightstick when you have a gun that you can point at, you know, black teenagers?
You know, what was interesting, I read the defense of what happened there by another cop, not a defense of that cop's action, but like, hey, lost in the story, there were some good cops there. There's video.
There were.
Were
some
other cops. Right, the other cops.
Them.
He started taking his gun. They were like, Larry!
Yeah.
For the love of God.
Yeah. They tried to stop him when he pulled his gun out and he just started pointing it at the teenagers there. Look, here's the thing. Whether you agree or disagree about police brutality in that video, the one thing that you cannot deny is that police are supposed to de-escalate the situation, and that is not what he did when he came in with a barrel roll, yeah, right?
Totally. Like, I think he tripped. I don't think he barrel rolled.
No, can I watch almost, this one
I don't
more
know.
Time.
It feels I like just, he was.
I know it looked this time. I saw it a lot when it happened. I think he tripped.
Look at him running toward them.
Out of the way, he yells to that girl, and then we don't really see the moment. No, he definitely fell.
He definitely fell. What is he doing?
But I mean, don't get me wrong. It's still worth watching because he fell.
Yeah.
And he left his flashlight or nightstick down because another cop's like, and then, you know, they're like, obviously it's Larry's.
Yeah.
And the reason he can get indicted may would to give the benefit of the doubt to the grand jury or to the prosecutor there. It's incredibly hard to convict a police officer. I mean, we need to make it a little easier to convict a police officer. Then more of them will get indicted because it's easier to convict. They can't in good conscience get an indictment if it's going to be impossible to convict. But I hope, most importantly, is that that guy, what's his name?
Eric Casebolt.
Eric Larry Casebolt. I hope, has he been fired?
Well, he's no longer a cop, so yeah. I don't know
he
if
said
he's forced
resigned
to resign.
After, yeah, I think
he was probably forced to resign, which, by the way, I mean, look, I'm happy with that outcome. Mm-hmm. At least he's no longer a cop. What always worries me is when you have clear cases of police brutality. And I'm going to be honest with you guys. Watching that video, he was unruly.
He was a terrible cop.
That's not the worst cop video we've seen.
No,
I mean,
not
we're
close.
So desensitized right, by the police right, brutality right, right. where unarmed people are literally running away from the cops and they get shot and killed and then they don't get indicted. Mm. Like, those are the cases that we're constantly dealing with. I'm just happy that he's not policing
anymore. Like, that girl was theoretically okay, at least.
She's okay.
At least physically
yeah.
okay. But, and
do you know, I wanted to go with the point you mentioned where it's very difficult to convict a police officer. I also think it's very difficult to convict a police officer, especially with the area that it's in, right? So McKinney, Texas, they did a little searching. I'm not sure if you guys did it, or if you did the story before when it first came out.
Yeah, we did.
And according to the story, I think BuzzFeed ran the report, the whole altercation that caused the police officers to come to the area is because one woman shouted at another, go back to Section 8, right? Mm-hmm. So it sounded like something from the Hunger Games. I didn't know what it was. So I did some research where the area is somewhat segregated. There's an area, there's a highway. The west of it is east of it is a certain area where the population of whites is 49%. And then in the other more suburban areas, it's around 89% mm-hmm. Whites in that area. So the area itself, although it was run in an article that was considered one of the best places to live, it also went on to say that they've got some problems with diversity and equity, especially when it comes to a police officer who's coming in full pelt mm-hmm. looking to try and de-escalate a situation. It's obvious that this guy had a sheer thought process that I'm going in, and as soon as I see the first black person that may be involved in an altercation,
I'm going to war.
That yes. is what he's thinking. It wouldn't surprise me if maybe he was ex-military, if he thinks that he's still in a war-torn situation, but he's coming in an area which, according to many reports, is still segregated, and he's coming in and he's thinking to himself, not even looking at a situation to de-escalate it, but he's thinking, if there's a skin color that's standing around not doing what I would personally want them to do, I'm going to use all my force.
Yeah, we don't
just ask a few questions before
and
you
that's all you're asking for. That's all you want.
Take a physical action, right? Like, you show up to the scene, there's been some sort of altercation. Ask a few questions, figure out who's in the wrong, right? Don't cause more chaos. You cause more chaos, you start getting physical with people who might not be doing anything wrong at all. Yeah, it's going to escalate the situation. That's mm-hmm. exactly what happened. You look at that video, and yeah, it looks like a lot of commotion, but part of that commotion is caused by the
almost
fact that
entirely
he comes...
him.
Yes, exactly.
And we see on that video, if you let the full thing play, there's at least one other cop, I think two other cops, who you hear talking to these kids, and here's what they're doing, talking. And at one point, too many people were talking, and the cop went, hey, quiet down.
Exactly.
I'm talking to
them.
Like it was
and that's
nobody
fine.
Right.
Yeah.
They were taking charge and calming it down and being that and he wasn't hand wasn't on his gun. There's nothing. He was talking to them.
Yeah.
And we don't know whether this guy's racist. And obviously this was a particularly bad situation in light of what we know to be true about black communities and police officers. So let's not kid ourselves. Obviously that's an issue. But this guy may well just be, you know, I mean, we've seen police brutality with powerless white people. And obviously with powerless brown people, the key almost always is the powerlessness of it. And this guy, I don't know whether it's racial. I know that any sort of tense situation, this guy should not be there, no matter what. Whether race or not, he got to go, and thankfully he's off.
You know when I worked, I ain't your slave, right?
You know I ain't shucking and jiving and high-fiving. You know this ain't back in the days, right? Well, I can't tell how the way they kill Freddie Gray, right? Chop down Mike Brown, how they get Trey, right?
Officer Cesar Goodson was acquitted of all charges against him in last year's death of Freddie Gray. Goodson faced the most serious charges in the case, second-degree depraved heart murder, manslaughter, reckless endangerment, and misconduct in office. WYPR's Kenneth Burns was in the courtroom as Circuit Judge Barry Williams read the verdict.
The courtroom was packed as Judge Barry Williams took nearly 45 minutes to read why he found Officer Goodson not guilty on all seven charges. Williams said the state did not prove that Officer William Porter told Goodson that Gray was in need of immediate medical care. Williams recalled Porter's testimony during the trial that while Gray was lethargic and docile, he didn't look like he was in medical distress. Prosecutors argued it was obvious that Gray was in need of medical care, but Williams said the type of injury Gray suffered would not be obvious to an average officer. He said the court was presented with a number of equally plausible scenarios. He discussed five that could have happened. Williams said unlike a shooting, stabbing, or car accident, there were no observable injuries, and that Gray's fatal injury manifested itself internally. The judge also addressed prosecutors' opening statement that Gray was subject to a rough ride. Williams said that the term rough ride is an inflammatory one requiring definition and then observable evidence. He added no specific evidence was presented to prove the rough ride theory. As the verdict was read, State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby lowered her head at times. Chief Deputy State's Attorney Michael Schatzow was writing notes, and Deputy State's Attorney Janice Bledsoe sat back in her chair. This was the state's third trial against the six officers charged last year in Freddie Gray's death from a fatal broken neck. The first trial against Officer William Porter ended last December in a hung jury. In the second trial, Officer Edward Nero was acquitted of all of the charges by Judge Williams last month. Defense Attorney Warren Brown, who has watched the trial, said he is not surprised that Williams acquitted Goodson.
The judge voiced his skepticism even in the motion for judgment of acquittal that he just didn't see evidence of a rough ride. He didn't see evidence of a depraved heart, and it was a stretch right from the beginning.
Brown also points out that Judge Williams, an African-American, used to prosecute police officers for the federal government before being appointed to the Maryland bench in 2005. And adds there couldn't have been a fairer person to adjudicate the case.
Throughout his opinion, he notably mentioned over and over that the state had failed to present evidence to support their contention. It's easy to understand how he could come to this decision.
Former city prosecutor Warren Alperstein was not surprised either. He said Judge Williams gave a preview during closing arguments when he pressed prosecutors over their rough ride theory.
It was a little bit of a foreshadowing, and ultimately Judge Williams cleared that up today, making it abundantly obvious that he didn't buy the state's argument that there was a rough ride given to Freddie Gray.
Outside of the courthouse.
Whole damn system is guilty as hell. Indict, convict, send those killer cops to jail.
A smattering of protesters chanted minutes before the verdict was announced. But when the verdict came, many said they knew what to expect. City resident Justin Sanders was among them.
I predicted this, and I think so did everybody, because this is what the system is designed to do. It's not designed to favor an oppressed minority over a security force. It's designed to get the security force off.
Protesters like Joshua Beasley of Glen Burnie decried a rigged system that gives police freedoms they don't feel like they have themselves.
It's rigged for them. It's made for them to win. It's made for them to, like, not get in trouble for nothing they do to us.
Harry Fitzgerald of Park Heights said the verdict was particularly sad because he could relate to Freddie Gray's experience.
I mean, I've been on a rough ride myself. You get in the back of that paddy wagon, I've never been seatbelted in. And they just drive like maniacs.
Kamal K.G. Dorchi said he, too, could relate. He said he spent 15 years in prison for an armed robbery. Given his experiences with police, Gray's experience could have been his.
I grew up as a kid, spending summertime in the Gilmore Projects, so that could have easily been me. It's a Baltimore City police thing, and, you know, they hate us just as much as we hate them.
Dorchi said that not only was he surprised at Williams' verdict in Goodson's case, but he also expects the rest of the police officers facing trial to be acquitted as well.
I think all of the officers should be exonerated based on what the medical examiner said. If the ME says nothing was wrong with him, then that's basically what the state's attorney have to go with, and that's the evidence that they have to present.
His companion, Angel Sala, said the city shouldn't bother going through with the other trials.
Because they already made the decision before they even walk into that court.
Sala called Gray's death a modern-day lynching. She carried a black bag strap tied around her neck, which she used to fake her own hanging. Her face bore black and white makeup, which she said represented a dividing line between Baltimore's black and white residents. NAACP President Cornell William Brooks called Gray's death and Goodson's acquittal tragedies, but he said the real tragedy is the longstanding tension between police and Baltimore's black communities.
The verdict of the community relative to their police department is a verdict of guilty. That is, guilty of having a long history of rough rides, guilty of having this chasm of distrust between the police department and the community.
But Delegate Kurt Anderson, the head of Baltimore's delegation in the Maryland House of Delegates, said Goodson's trial and the trials of the other officers involved in Gray's death showed that the justice system works.
They had a fair and impartial judge listen to the facts, and the judge came to the conclusion that the state had not presented enough evidence to find him guilty. Basically, that's the definition of what justice is in our criminal justice system.
Fraternal Order of Police President Gene Ryan said his group is very pleased and extremely grateful that Goodson was acquitted.
As anticipated, the facts of this case speak for themselves. Officer Goodson was not at fault.
Ryan also wants State's Attorney Mosby to drop the charges against the remaining four officers, Lieutenant Brian Rice, whose trial is scheduled to begin next month, Officer Garrett Miller, Officer Porter, and Sergeant Alicia White, calling the prosecution malicious.
We are more than certain that they, too, will be found to be without guilt. To continue this travesty is an insult to the taxpaying citizens of Baltimore who, at the end of the day, bear the full burden of the enormous cost of these trials that have no merit and continue to divide our city.
Ryan accused Mosby of playing politics with police, making it harder for officers to do their jobs. There is no reaction from Mosby or prosecutors. They remain under a gag order from Judge Williams, as does Goodson and defense attorneys. With reporting from Rachel Bay and Samantha Max, I'm Kenneth Burns for 88.1. WYPR.
I want to be a cop.
The death of Freddie Gray still has a lot of people thinking about their relationship to the police. We're going to hear now from Jared Marcel. He's a 27-year-old New Yorker, and for him, that relationship is complicated. His story comes to us from WNYC's Radio Rookies.
Tuck your shirt in and wear your pants on your waist. Try to frown less and smile more. Be respectful. I heard those things a million times from my parents.
There was just raising kids properly. There was a way I wanted my boys to be raised, black or not.
My mom was also trying to protect us. By the time I was 15, I had grown bigger and looked a lot older than I was. Cops didn't see the good black boy my mom raised because 6'3", 290-pound black guys who aren't playing football are always up to no good. I had to deal with harassment, name-calling, and on several occasions, use of unjustified force. One time when I was 18, a cop punched me in the face.
What are your thoughts on the interactions between me and the police?
I'm very saddened, definitely angry at how you've been treated.
You know, people have no idea, like, how that could affect you. When, you know, I've had so many run-ins with the cops, Mom. That it didn't just affect my relationship with the cops, it affected how I viewed society, maybe how I even treated, you know, white people, you know what I'm saying? I don't hate anybody, but I began to resent them in the sense that I felt like the cops were targeting me because they were trying to protect them.
The thought that you're a problem can really change you. It's even affected my confidence, walking down the street, wondering if people see me as a suspect. The cops are public servants, so if they're profiling me, the public must be afraid of me. Just last summer, I was hanging out with my boys outside my house.
But you gotta say, yeah, stylist.
I'm a unicorn.
And we like, we chill, hanging out in front of, you know what I mean, your crib. Like.
That's Tyrone. Suddenly, an unmarked car pulled up and rolled down his windows. I knew what time it was. I waved at the passengers. What's up, officers? How's everything going? But that wasn't what they wanted to hear, so they hopped out on us.
Asking if we have guns, drugs.
They asked Tyrone if they could search his car. I was stunned by that because we were just minding our own business in front of my house.
So they then started to provoke us, trying to get us to react.
Everybody started cursing each other out, face to face, man to man. Eventually, I was able to turn things around because I have a golden ticket. My sister Leanna is a cop. I pulled out a badge she'd given me just to let them know my sister was Internal Affairs. That's the department where the police police themselves. The whole mood changed. Now they wanted to reason with me instead of being aggressive.
How did you feel when I told you about the incident when the cops were messing with me outside?
It bothered me because, you know, here I am 30 feet from it, not knowing what's going on, and knowing that that interaction could have gone either way. It could have gone south very easily. It bothered me very much.
Okay, well, how about this? Do you remember telling me, breaking the news that you were taking the police test?
I don't really remember the exact moment that I told you.
Even though it was 6 years ago, I remember it.
I was watching TV in your room, and you said it in passing.
I seem to remember that when I told you, I think I made an excuse as to why. Well, you know, it's a good job, and, you know, I was trying to, like, soften the blow that I knew it would be to you.
Did you ever, like, feel like you were switching sides?
Switching sides?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you know how I've, you know, some of my feelings towards the cops in the past.
Yeah, I never really felt that I was on a side to switch. I mean, I don't feel like there's a side of cop versus civilian or us versus them. I think there's right and wrong.
Not too long after Leanna became a police officer, word on the street was she was actually patrolling our neighborhood. Apparently, she intervened when a couple of my boys got stopped by other cops. Yo, Jared, your sister is all right. When some real street cats confirmed what she was doing, I could no longer deny it. Leanna was different. If only the NYPD had more officers like her.
Jared Marcel is with Radio Rookies out of WNYC.
Come on, hit me up with some of that thug. Yeah, that's like that. Hit him in the chest with it. One time again in the head. But buddy roll, y'all. Check it out.
I don't know what this world's gonna be, but I know one thing, that this is the life for me.
Baby, cause I'm a thug.
A Florida prosecutor has been suspended after he went on a social media rant regarding clubs in Orlando after the horrific Orlando shooting. Now, in his posts, Kenneth Lewis, the prosecutor, wrote the following. He referred to downtown Orlando as a melting pot of third world miscreants and ghetto thugs.
This guy sounds great.
Keep in mind, he's a prosecutor for Orlando. And he also says all Orlando nightclubs should be permanently closed with or without random gunmen. They are zoos, utter cesspools of debauchery. I agree about the cesspools of debauchery, but that's in all clubs all throughout the United States. That's what clubs are for. And then finally, he is no stranger to controversy. In fact, back in 2014, Lewis posted a social media-related controversy. He was ordered to undergo sensitivity training after authoring a 2014 Facebook post that wished a happy Mother's Day to all the crack hoes out there. Why is he suspended? Why is he not fired? I don't understand.
Okay, look, this is dangerous. You can't have a prosecutor that's biased against certain races. And even if you think, well, hey, don't make assumptions about crack hoes or ghetto thugs. Gee, I wonder who he's referring to there. I'm not quite sure. But third world miscreants can't be misunderstood. No one's ever referred to white people anywhere as third world miscreants in this country. That's not a thing that happens. So don't pretend like, what racial component? I don't know. White people could be in a ghetto, right? No. We know where he's going here. And it's one thing to talk about debauchery in clubs and to celebrate that. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's another thing after 50 people had been murdered in a nightclub in Orlando, which was a gay nightclub, and then you say, oh, we should get rid of that cesspool of debauchery. That's a whole different matter.
Yeah, look, him posting this after what happened in Orlando shows that he's blaming the victims of what happened, right? And so just keep in mind that he is a prosecutor. He's the type of person who's supposed to bring justice when it comes to criminal wrongdoing. And in this case, instead of blaming the actual criminal, he's blaming the club goers. I mean, that shows that you have a lack of judgment, to say the least, when it comes to your career. So I wouldn't want this guy to be a prosecutor.
And after this guy goes and he's a Muslim guy, does a shooting, I guess you could connect it to third world miscreants in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, he was an American, but I get it for a guy like this. Like, looks foreign to me, right? But why bring ghetto thugs into it? Because you don't like those people, right? So now, look, on the one hand, you can say, hey, well, look, this guy deals with criminals all the time. Yeah, but then you make really important decisions on who to prosecute and to what degree to prosecute them. Mm-hmm. So if your assumptions are and those decisions are informed based on race, well, I can't have you representing the people of Orlando mm-hmm. and saying, hey, you know what? If I see somebody's ghetto or they're a crack hoe or they're third worlders, then I'm going to prosecute them more. Mm-hmm. That is dangerous. Now, I think firing someone is a very heavy thing to do. I'm usually reluctant to say someone should be fired. But in a case like this, I can't have you as a prosecutor if I can't trust that justice isn't blind and that you're picking who to prosecute based on their race. That is beyond unacceptable.
Georgia. Folks, shocking news out of Georgia. The Department of Justice says they are not going to file charges in the death of Kendrick Johnson. He is a young black kid found dead inside of a mat in a high school. They say he climbed into the mat to retrieve a gym shoe. Are you serious? After the ruling, the Department of Justice released this statement in part. After extensive investigation into this tragic event, federal investigators determined that there is insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone or some group of people willfully violated Kendrick Johnson's civil rights or committed any other prosecutorial federal crime. Accordingly, the investigation into this incident has been closed without the filing of federal criminal charges. Though local and state investigators ruled Johnson's death a freak accident, his parents, Kenneth and Jackie Johnson, have always believed their son was murdered. The Johnson family filed a $100 million wrongful death suit shortly after their son's death, but it was withdrawn earlier this year. Joining us via Skype is the public safety reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Christian Boone. And, of course, joining me on the panel today in D.C., Tiffany Vlofton, former USSA president, also a campaign strategist, Paris Denard, GOP communication strategist, George Jefferson Newry, founding CEO in the Public Eye Communications, Dr. Wilma Leon, political scientist, Sirius XM radio show host. You've been covering this case, Christian, and I'm still perplexed as to how they determine that he somehow died trying to get a gym shoe.
Well, if you think of the gym mat as stacked vertically, and he used to share a pair of shoes with another student, a lot of the kids would leave their shoes underneath the mats. The theory is that he was in a rush to get to class, and instead of moving the mat as he normally did, he was on a bleacher sort of coming over and reached under and sort of got a sword swallowed up, if you will, into the mat.
Well, what also jumps out at me, which is troubling, is that video was missing. How you had these camera angles that showed what was happening in the gym, but when it was time for the portion of the tape to see him in the mat, video goes blank.
Yes, I understand that the video was motion detected, so I mean it was dependent on, you know, movement. I know it was the video was analyzed at the Quantico during the federal investigation. But yeah, no one's seen the actual, except for I think FBI agents have actually seen every bit of footage that they have.
Reaction from the parents has certainly not been accepting of this DOJ ruling.
No, not at all. And, you know, I think that really the DOJ here has got some, or the U.S. Attorney's Office has some responsibility, because I believe that they, I think the parents were led to believe that there would be something coming. And, you know, when they got the word yesterday that there was nothing, I think they were run for a loop.
I want to go to our panel here, Wilmer. This case has bothered people for a long time. Athlete here, very much in the shape. Climbing into a mat to get a shoe when he could have pushed the mat over to get the shoe.
This is the Zapruder film. This is the magic bullet. This makes absolutely no sense. And when you look at how tightly wound into the mat the body is, logic just tells us he was rolled into the mat by other people to hide the body.
Because if that mat, if he had come across the top and come into that mat, the force of his body as the mat moved over would have opened up. I think the Justice Department, since there is no statute of limitation on murder, should leave this case open. I think there's a missing shoe. Sorry. There's a missing piece here that will unfold as time goes by. Just say, we don't know what's going on, we're going to leave it open, and we're going to keep investigating this, because there's no way at the weight of that young man's body was that so tightly rolled when it fell over. And what killed him when it fell over? He's on a mat.
And it would probably unroll once it fell over.
And it's air, right, exactly.
Well, Christian, the other problem that we had is that at the outset, the medical examiner and the sheriff's department were not as willing to help with, so there was a lot of drama there as well in terms of how they behaved.
Right. There was some questions some back and forth between actually the medical examiner, the local medical examiner, and the sheriff's office about how that was handled, which raised, I think, you know, additional questions for people who thought that this was a, you know, mysterious death in the first place.
Paris.
I think the thing that's unfortunate here is that the family still doesn't have a full sense of closure. They don't have closure in the sense they don't know really what happened to their son. They don't have closure in the sense that they don't know really what happened in terms of who did this. And so there's a sense of injustice that still is pervasive. And then the community and his peers and his friends who may go to the same school might be thinking, well, could this happen to me? And what would happen from a legal standpoint, what happened from the school standpoint, if I got into the same situation with this type of scenario of inconclusive results happen, and then would the DOJ not come to our rescue? So it's an unfortunate situation all across the board.
Roland, I think the justice is supposed to tell the truth. And so now we have parents who are hearing back from legal authorities that we're sorry for the loss of your son. We are unable to tell you what happened to him. I don't have any kids. I've said this before on the show. But every time we have a situation like this,
right,
we also hear every single time that they can't tell us the truth.
Yep.
Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, now Kendrick Johnson. And there are several stories after time, after time, after time, where we're supposed to unpack and know
right
what happened. You said the video piece is missing and all those other things. It's unfortunate, but we have to figure out in this country, how do we continue to put a special emphasis on Black lives to make sure we're actually able to hear what happened to those folks?
All right, Christian, we certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Officials in Mississippi are now closing the investigation into one of the most notorious murders of the civil rights era, the killing by the Ku Klux Klan of three young Freedom Summer activists. Here's Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood.
This sort of closes a chapter on an era that we didn't want to have
in public view. We were ashamed of that.
The decision comes 52 years after James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner were killed in Neshoba County, Mississippi. NPR's Debbie Elliott has been following the case since it was reopened in the late 1990s, and she joins us now. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning.
Today is the anniversary of the 64 Neshoba County murders, mm-hmm. and federal and state authorities now say they've concluded the investigation and are releasing the final FBI report. Why now?
Well, Attorney General Hood says more prosecutions are unlikely now.
It's just got to the point where it's 52 years later, and we've done all we can do.
You know, the passage of time means that memories have faded. Both participants in this crime and many of the witnesses have since died. Evidence hasn't been preserved. Now, there are at least two known suspects who are still alive, but the state hasn't been able to build a strong enough case against them to prosecute. The state has only convicted one man in the murders. That was Klan leader Edgar Ray Killen. He was known as Preacher Killen. He's 91 and remains jailed on manslaughter charges for orchestrating the killings.
Debbie, you covered the Killen trial back in 2005. Can you remind mm-hmm. us about that crime and why it took so long to bring justice?
Well, in 1964, it was Freedom Summer. Young people from around the country had come to Mississippi to work with local civil rights activists to register voters and to set up schools for disenfranchised African Americans. Chaney, Goodwin, and Schwerner were working at this black church that was just outside of Philadelphia, Mississippi. It had been the target of Klan violence the week before. They left the neighborhood of that church. They had a run-in with local authorities. They were arrested. They were put in jail. And shortly after they were released, they went missing. And there was all this national attention at the time, the drama of the search. Some say because two of the workers were white. James Chaney was a black man from Meridian, Mississippi. At the time, Mississippi officials were calling it a hoax devised to garner sympathy for the civil rights movement.
So when did they figure out that it wasn't a hoax?
It was 44 days later. Their bodies were found buried in an earthen dam off a remote country road. They had been shot to death. 22 Klansmen were implicated in the murder conspiracy, including the local sheriff and his deputy. Now, at the time, federal officials brought civil rights charges, and 8 people were convicted in 1967. But the state refused to bring murder charges, and it was 4 decades later that Edgar Ray Killen was tried and convicted. He is now serving a 60-year prison sentence. Hmm.
So, Debbie, what's the reaction been like to the case being closed?
You know, I'm not sure anyone really expected more prosecutions, although there was always the hope that someone might have a deathbed confession and be willing to offer more details of what happened. I spoke yesterday with Rita Schwerner Bender. That's Mickey Schwerner's widow. She was working with him in Mississippi in 1964. She says it's long since been too late to achieve justice here, and she still has very harsh words for the state of Mississippi, which she says was complicit in the racism and violence at the time and has failed to acknowledge that official role and make amends for it.
NPR's Debbie Elliott. Thanks so much, Debbie.
You're welcome.
I was on a mission from God.
That's James Meredith. He and a few others started walking from Memphis on June 5th, 1966. It was a way to encourage blacks to take a stand and to register to vote. The next day, he went through the town of Hernando.
When I arrived in Hernando, Mississippi, every black that considered himself anybody was there to greet James Meredith.
But his march would soon face a flashpoint a few miles down the road. Aram Gutsuzian is chair of the Department of History at the University of Memphis. He's the author of the book Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. He says a man called out from the woods when Meredith was on U.S. 51 just south of Hernando.
And then all of a sudden, a white man yells out of the gully, James Meredith,
I only want James Meredith. And he comes out with his rifle, and he shoots three times, and he wounds Meredith. Meredith is writhing on the side of the highway, covered in blood.
Jack Thornell was a photographer for the Associated Press. He captured the shooting in a series of photos.
There's one single frame of him grimacing in pain.
That picture won the Pulitzer Prize for photography that year. Thornell didn't realize at the time how powerful his picture was as it made its way around the world.
And I'm sure they were having an impact. I had no idea that that was a responsibility of mine or anyone else. That was just the way it was. You were a news photographer and you went out to cover the stuff and you did your job.
James Meredith survived the shooting. The sniper, Aubrey James Norville, was a former hardware salesman from Memphis. He later pleaded guilty to assault and battery with intent to kill and served 2 years in prison. His motive for the shooting remains a mystery.
The man that shot me was so irrelevant. It was more than 40 years before it was important enough for me to find out who he was. Because he didn't leave home to shoot me. He got caught up in the whatchamacallit of the day. The people responsible were the rulers of Mississippi.
Meredith says the shooting took his mission off course.
But because I got shot, the evening news was that James Meredith is dead, and then they corrected that. And it completely got lost what my mission was.
While Meredith recovered, a group of prominent civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael, took over the march, growing it to thousands of people. Flonzy Brown Wright, known as Flonzy Goodloe back then, worked for the NAACP. She recalls receiving a phone call from King to organize a place to stay and food for thousands of marchers when they came to Canton.
When I hung up the phone, that's when I became real nervous. But who was going to tell Dr. King no? Because I knew they had been on this march for a number of days in June in the hot sun. And so certainly if I could do something in my hometown of Canton to relieve them, to be sure that they had food, housing, then of course I was honored to do that.
History professor Gudzusian says King and Carmichael were friends but had conflicting perspectives. He says the march was a pivotal point for the civil rights movement.
It is the last great mass march of the civil rights movement, the last time where major civil rights organizations come together, participate in a long, sustained demonstration that attracts national attention and then becomes a political lobbying tool. It's a beginning in the sense that it births the slogan of Black Power and helps to launch a slogan that is both controversial in terms of inviting a white backlash, but also empowering for many African Americans.
Meredith rejoined the march near the end, 3 weeks after the shooting.
The two names most connected, besides James Meredith, to the Meredith March Against Fear, as it is known. Stokely Carmichael, you think of Black Power. Martin Luther King, you think of I Have a Dream. My wish. When people think of James Meredith, they think of good and right.
Several entertainers, including Sammy Davis Jr., Marlon Brando, and James Brown, also participated in a rally along the march at Tougaloo College. The march concluded in Jackson on June 26, 1966. More than 4,000 blacks registered to vote during those 3 weeks in Mississippi. Mark Rigsby, MPB News.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower.
It's great to learn,
cause knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block on your favorite Schoolhouse Rockin'.
Well, the Sepulpa School Board acknowledged today leadership concerns that came to light when a former principal's resignation letter went public. That letter accuses the superintendent of making racist comments to employees and downplaying a major racial issue within the district. One employee tells News on 6 reporter Tess Monty he was a victim of discrimination.
A strong man don't pose to cry, but this has really beat me down.
Trent Kirvin has been a Sepulpa School's maintenance worker for more than a decade.
It's so devastating, hard to talk about.
Kirvin is the employee Bobby Alfred referred to in his resignation letter as being subjected to unspeakable acts of racism by a supervisor.
And you have to take it, take it, take it. And it beats you down, until it has beat the manhood out of you. That's not right.
The school can't comment on personnel issues, but Kirvin says the district found his supervisor had discriminated against him, but still praised that supervisor when he took an early retirement.
It just swept under the rug and dealt with in a manner that we don't care. You know, he's a black man and we don't care. As long as he keep his mouth shut.
The school board held a special meeting to address the allegations in the letter. The room was packed with parents, teachers, and students supporting Alfred and Kirvin.
The school board was in executive session for about an hour and a half, and when they came out, they read a statement that left many parents with more questions than answers.
Legally, that's probably how they have to handle things, but that didn't do anything for the school. It didn't do anything for all these people it's here to support.
And it didn't do anything for Kirvin, who was hoping for change more than anything else.
Words are very powerful, but action is more powerful.
Well, the board statement says it does take the allegations regarding the school operations very seriously, and they've hired an attorney, but cannot comment any further.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 25th, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in. Folks have observations, views, suggestions they would like to share. Feel free. Dial in. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We should be here tomorrow. I've been looking to have more guests from South Africa. Just again, they have a lot of anniversaries in that part of the world in the month of June as well. They just had the 40-year anniversary of the Soweto uprisings, student uprisings from 1976, and it's also the 20-year recognition of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So they're doing a lot of reflecting on that, and then contrasting those movements, particularly the Soweto student uprising, to the current movement that's been happening at a lot of the universities about roads must fall and fees must fall, addressing issues of racism, white supremacy. Unfortunately, a lot of the same issues that they were discussing 40 years ago. Anywho, folks, I think the segment that I played on the compensatory call-in from last weekend from the stream, they had a panel of guests. I think everybody was from in the area of the world known as South Africa. And one of the guests, it's going to take me literally like a good 30 minutes to just keep practicing her name. It is a doozy. But she was one of the activists that was on. She's been involved in a lot of the student activities and what have you for the past few years. And just in addition, she happens to be like stunningly gorgeous. But always great to have black people from different parts of the world on the program. She should be here tomorrow. Obviously, there's a 9-hour time difference between my part of the world and South Africa. So she'll be here tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, and 12 noon Pacific. But it'll be great to talk about, hear some of her views on racism, white supremacy, if she has paid any attention to the U.S. presidential election, thoughts on President Obama, certainly what they've been talking about in South Africa over the past few years, thoughts on Madiba, quite a few things. If she's familiar with Christopher Clark, the white man who was with us last week in South Africa, journalist sexually suing a black female over there, it will be grand to hear her perspective on that and much more. Again, tomorrow, early time, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific, live from South Africa. Moving forward. Let's see. There are several things I wanted to touch on. One of them, I wanted to make sure I got this in. I'll mention it a few more times as we roll. If you have been listening to the Cavs for a while, back in 2012, we had a guest on from Israel, as I just said. Always grand to hear from folks, different parts of the world, just to get more evidence that this is a global problem that we are talking about. I think it's very important to keep that in mind, to be thinking locally, nationally, globally. When we talk about racism, white supremacy, I think racists, they try to do a really good job of get us to have us thinking in a very niggardly manner, that this is restricted, that racism, white supremacy is isolated to one specific region. Like, you can go someplace and there's no racism. That is a great lie. But we had a black female on the program, Efrat Yerideh. She joined us live from the area of the world known as Israel. And we talked about white supremacy in that part of the world, that specifically them sterilizing black females as they came into the country. A lot of overlap with medical apartheid. She said, she emailed me just a couple days ago. She says she's supposed to be making a visit to New York. Obviously, that is thousands of miles from where I reside. But I do know that we have a good chunk of New York listeners. She said she's looking, you know, constructive things to do. This is someone, she's an activist. She's doing constructive work on a regular basis against racism. So if there's some constructive things, some fun things that you know that would be going down New York City, unless I have been mistaken, most of the time I don't hear people saying that they're coming from outside the U.S., that they're coming to New York, and they mean like Rochester or Albany or Syracuse. Most of the time they're going to New York City. So folks know of things, and she's going to be there specifically in August. So any of our folks who are in the NYC area, or you frequent there enough that you kind of know things that are on the horizon for August of this summer, let me know if you would be interested. You'll have maybe a month and a half or so. If you would be interested in maybe doing some emailing, you wouldn't mind forwarding your email to her if you heard her on the program, or even if you didn't, if you're just interested in having contact with another victim of racism and having constructive exchange of views, show her the town or what have you, told her I would ask and I could forward her, or I could forward your information to her. And then if you all want to converse that way, and when she gets into the country, you all can chat it up in person and you can, you know, show her some of the town. That would be great. I'm sure she would appreciate it. Just drop me an email and you can put, you can put Jewish guests. That'd be great because she does identify as being Jewish, if I remember correctly, which just further underlies why I say that, you know, we should be accurate when we identify what the problem is. The problem is not that a person identifies as Jewish. The problem is individuals classified as white practicing white supremacy. That is the problem. But I'll announce that a few more times as we roll, because I know she really would appreciate having some contacts when she comes here. Moving along. I thought this was really important. There were audio segments, one in particular, but it wasn't as good as the article, so I'm just going to read this really quick. This is from colorlines.com. The article, Omar Mateen, that is the alleged killer in the nightclub down in Orlando, Florida, from 2 weeks ago. Omar Mateen's alleged former lover describes Pulse massacre as revenge for rejection. Just thought this was really important in how we process this whole event. And I also think it's important to just kind of keep in mind that much of the reporting around this incident has been a lot of contradictory things reported. And just in my view, it's difficult to ascertain accurate information. It just seems like an event that racists have done a very good job in orchestrating confusion and using this in a political manner to spread deceit, deception, and to obfuscate the problem, racism, white supremacy. So the article reads, as media and federal investigators struggle to fully understand the man who massacred 49 predominantly queer and Latina folks at Orlando's Pulse nightclub, one man who alleges a sexual relationship with Omar Mateen said that the shooter murdered in revenge against gay Latino men. Now, to me, that might even be an act of racism if these are individuals classified as non-white, but moving forward. I've cried like you have no idea, the man said in an exclusive interview with Univision, published Tuesday, June 21st. But the thing that makes me want to tell the truth is that he didn't do it for terrorism. In my opinion, he did it for revenge. The man, who identified as Miguel and wears a disguise, told Univision anchor Maria Elena Salinas that he met with Mateen through the dating app Grindr and that they have engaged in a two-month-long friends with benefits relationship. He described Mateen as a very sweet guy and said that Mateen felt rejected and spurned by Latino men. Again, I don't use that term, but I suspect this just could be not the most accurate language for describing individuals classified as not white. Continuing, this is a direct quote. He felt used by them. There were moments in the Pulse nightclub that made him feel really bad. Guys used him. They really affected him. That really affected him. I believe this crazy, horrible thing he did, that was revenge. Miguel also said that Mateen believed he may have contracted HIV after group sex with two Puerto Rican men, one of whom later disclosed having HIV. When asked about Mateen's professed allegiance to ISIS, Miguel said that Mateen saw Islam as an accepting and loving religion in contrast to his father's more rigid beliefs. Univision could not verify Miguel's whole story, but reported that the FBI confirmed having met with him. Miguel told Univision that the FBI interviewed him three times. And has the link. You can watch the video. They have the transcript of the interview that Miguel, quote unquote, did on Univision, or you can watch the video if you're interested in checking it out. But I thought this was very important. This is not the only piece of information. There have been others as well that to me suggest that this is a very different narrative than what they have laid out. If anything, this might even be gay on gay crime. I haven't heard that term at all. As opposed to the war on gays, this might just be gay on gay crime, where this guy was himself, quote unquote, gay and was angry about being rejected or whatever he experienced in his homosexual, anti-sexual behavior and got upset about that and took that out on this murderous rampage against individuals predominantly who were non-white. That to me just does not at all qualify as a quote-unquote hate crime. If anything, and I think we've kind of been saying this all along, this might just be another means of racism, white supremacy, where predominantly non-white people were slaughtered, killed, maimed, mistreated, that this is not something where they were going specifically to harm these individuals because they were gay, unless we're going to call this gay on gay crime. And I have never in my life heard that term used. Anywho, other quick things that I thought were important to make sure we pointed out. I did not include audio segment about the whole sit-in that lasted for a day this week. That they had Congressmember John Lewis of infamous from the Civil Rights Movement, where they sat in for gun control. I do not ever in life want to hear anything about quote-unquote gun control in this area of the world again. That is the biggest. You want to talk about what they call a red herring? That is like nonsense to the extreme. I mean, that's almost getting into the territory when they say, hey, I got a nice bridge I can sell you. I don't want to ever hear that again mumbled on this program or anywhere else in life. White people are not ever, you can add one more, ever going to pass any legislation at all about confiscating firearms, weapons from whites in this part of the world. You are never going to see that happen for any reason. I don't care how many schools they shoot up, burn down. They can shoot up the McDonald's. They can shoot up 20 churches. I don't care what they shoot up. They are not going to take firearms from whites. If anything, that could be the gun industry that, hey, our sales are sagging a little bit. Go out there and tell them that they're going to pass legislation to take their guns away, and that'll ramp scales up, because I've seen reports repeatedly that that's exactly what happens every time that somebody mumbles that nonsense that, oh my gosh, they're going to take our guns. That no good Obama is going to pass that. Bam. The gun stores, oh my gosh, banner sales. We got to go to the bank. The cash register is literally bursting. That's what happens every time. It is not going to happen. I am not ever interested in entertaining that for 5 seconds. It is not going to happen. That's one thing I can say I've come to a firm conclusion on, that that's just more racist nonsense. Moving forward, There were a couple other things that I was going to catch in, but I can kind of sprinkle those in as we go. The last thing, just the segment that you heard about the black male teacher that had endured all of these racist insults and seemed like it had just really terrorized him. That was in Oklahoma, just for geographic location of where it was happening at. I thought of Mr. Fuller since he was born there as well. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. If you know you have a lot of noise in the background, if you're traveling, people have televisions or radios on in the background or what have you, or other people are talking, just use your mute button. That way you can speak, say whatever you want to say, and then mute your line. That way it'll preserve the quality of the broadcast and we don't have a lot of distortion on what have you on the line. No speakerphone, please. If you're driving and all of that stuff, same principle, just mute your line. If you're driving, we want folks to be safe. If you do want to participate, but just speak and then mute your line when you're done. That way we don't have the echo and all that in the background as we're trying to go, as we're trying to discourse. No metaphors. I feel like I have to say this really slowly and several times because people continue to insist that I've said no metaphors at all, or you can't use metaphors on the cows ever. I have not said that. What I say every compensatory call-in is no metaphors for this specific broadcast, the compensatory call-in. I don't say anything about metaphors on any of the other programs, and I use them myself. Just this program, just because I do think it's important that we are alert and mindful, because metaphors, in my opinion, are used consistently, and I would say it's done deliberately by whites on a regular basis, where they employ metaphors to add confusion, to be deceptive when talking about racism, white supremacy, and other topics, where this is being conducted in a deliberate manner. And I think it's very important that we be aware of that so we are not confused. I think a lot of times non-white people, we use metaphors when we're talking about racism, white supremacy. Sometimes it's just out of convenience. When you are speaking extemporaneously, sometimes it can be difficult to get the exact wording in terms of how you want to articulate your views about racism or counter-racism, and sometimes just a metaphor, and particularly if it's a metaphor that everyone has heard or is familiar with, that can be an easy way to express yourself. That's something, in my opinion, we need to be very careful about. Unfortunately, the system of white supremacy has contaminated our thinking and sometimes our reflexive responses, our reflexive grasps at metaphors or ways of communicating. A lot of times can reinforce white supremacy, and just very simply, a lot of times the metaphors are inaccurate. The two things that are being compared or contrasted, they are not equivalent, and just that right there is adding confusion and being inaccurate in the way that we talk about racism, white supremacy. Let's strive to be accurate. You do not need metaphors to communicate. Strive for accuracy for this program specifically. No metaphors. Thank you kindly. I appreciate it if folks could respect that for this broadcast as we communicate. With that, if you could roughly take about 5 minutes to express your views, that'll give everybody an opportunity to communicate. We don't have the workplace racism segment here anymore, so we should have lots of time for folks to share their thoughts. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up should be with us. Feel free if you have commentary you would like to share.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just have two things. I actually sent, expressed them to you earlier this week on Wednesday. I'll just read it as I posted it on your Facebook. Two interesting cases here in South Florida. First, at a high school, the high school, the exact name of the high school was Cooper City. At a high school, baseball players decided to haze, bully, rape prospective teammates with the condonement of the of one of the coaches. Basically, on the news, it had copies of of their text messages, and the coach was actually chastising the victims to take it like a man. You know, one of the anti-sexual maneuvers that was being done to them was sick white people were putting their fingers up the anuses of the victims. And the coach basically told them to, you know, take it. I haven't heard anything else on the story. And it hasn't been really talked about a whole lot down here. The reason why the white racist part of this case has me thinking about the anti-sexual pathology that white people carry on. I'm pretty sure that all people involved were more than likely were white people. Based on what I know about the high school, who goes to the high school, and just their general behavior is quite consistent all over the world. The second case was a sobbing, crying white female at Florida International University, which is down here in Dade County. The other case was in a county called Broward County, which is just adjacent to Dade County. And Cooper City High School is actually about 15, 20 minutes away from my place of residence. But anyway, back to FIU. Crying, sobbing white female on the witness stand explaining how she was raped, fondled by a black male student. Mind you, she invited him into her room, invited him into the room, and when he asked for to give her a hug or something, the jury, I could have sworn that he was going to get convicted just off of that alone, because we know how dangerous white females are, and a white female crying in front of people really gets people's attention, unfortunately. But nevertheless, this was the news said it was an all-female jury. I would bet you that all-female jury, probably most of the jurors probably were black females. I can't say for sure, but it'll be my guess that most of the jury was black females. I also suspect her roommate. She mentioned about a roommate that she didn't get along with when asked about why didn't you report the case on a sooner basis. She said that she didn't get along with her roommate. I would have bet that the roommate was a black female. Anyway, I wrote down here that because she was suspected of the jurors suspected that she was hiding the fact of cheating on her boyfriend, who was in the same fraternity as the defendant. Mind you now, as I said, the defendant was a black male. 9 times out of 10, a black male, if he's going to join a fraternity, is going to be one of those quote-unquote black fraternities, Omega Psi Phi, Kappa Alpha Psi, and whatnot, that sort of thing. So I'm suspecting that also her boyfriend, who was a friend of the defendant, was a black male also. You know, just all way interesting case. But anyway, this black male was ruled not guilty on all charges. And I was just sitting there looking at the news that if they ruled him not guilty, they interviewed him afterwards. And I just hope that he answers to his wake-up call, unlike Mr. Renthal James Simpson. And that's all I have for. Thank you.
Renthal James. Fascinating indeed. The other folks that we have not heard from, if you all have commentary, feel free. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to the firefighter in Florida and all the other callers and listeners. I wanted to touch on first the clip with the black male whose sister was a police officer in the Internal Affairs Division. I thought it was great, black self-respect, for her to actually help black people in their community avoid police terrorism by assisting while she was on duty. I thought that was really great. One thing that I found kind of showed her brother's better understanding of the system and her lack of understanding of the system was when they got to the point where they discussed her first telling her brother about her transitioning to go to school to become a police officer or go through that process. And when her brother said to her, did you feel like you had to take sides between basically your community, your family, versus the blue wall of silence, essentially, is what I guess he was referring to. I would say just the, her taking sides, in a sense, I guess, against her own community for the police department to not use, I guess, a metaphor. Sorry about that. And when she said that she did not feel that she was taking a side, I just found that that really exemplified a serious lack of understanding of the system. I've always said that I believe black children, no matter where they are, what school system they go to, if they're homeschooled, should always get a history lesson on the origin of the police department. And especially black people who are choosing to go into law enforcement, I think if you understand how that entire division of law enforcement was created for the direct subjugation and terrorism of black people and the protection of white life and white property, I think if they understand that, it might deter quite a few people from getting into that particular industry. Those that are more knowledgeable and sensible about understanding history and making conscious decisions based on that. Of course, there'll always be some black people who just, you know, they want to go ahead with it, and that's fine. But I think that that's very important, because she might not have said that, or she might have said something different had she been educated in that sense. I found the Kendrick Johnson clip to be very upsetting, simply because the way the system works, like I think it was a female in the clip, they never figure out what happened to black people, especially when it's an incident involving racism, white supremacy. But yet with white people, they'll take years and do all kinds of, you know, investigations, even if they have to travel across the world. I remember when the white female Natalie Holloway disappeared in the Caribbean, it took a number of years for them to... They never do when black people are killed, and I just found that to be very telling. I feel I pray that his family can, you know, work through that on an emotional and spiritual level, because I know it's really tough. Also, I just wanted to touch on the... I did send you an article recently, Gus, regarding there was a safety board that recently okayed the first CRISPR trial to genetically alter humans. So they're definitely moving forward with that. It looks like it started in China, where they started to make changes to different embryos, and they said that 28 of these embryos were successful. And also, they also had in another article, it says the world's first genetically modified babies will graduate high school this year. And I'll just read the first paragraph. It says, remember the science thriller, sci-fi thriller Gattaca? For those who never saw the film and or eschewed all pop culture in the late 90s, for some reason, it was a popular movie that came out in 1997 about genetically modified human beings. Now some literally genetically modified human babies born that same year are entering their senior year of high school. So essentially, they started it back then. I've always said that whenever you see any sort of technology that's displayed by white people, normally that means that for years they've already been doing those things. They just have not told the public. And that's, I guess, the first concrete sign of that being the case. And I will stop there and allow someone else to speak. Thank you very much for taking my call, Gus.
Yeah, I thought with that New York, the clip on the enforcement, the black female who joined the police department in New York, reminded me some of the conversations we've had about whether or not black people should become enforcement officials. My suspicion was that I think there are probably more than a few black people who join police departments with that same mentality that I can do this and maybe try to help black people to some degree. And I also thought when her brother said he, you know, got information that she intervened when some of his friends were, I guess, being harassed by other enforcement officials, and she was able to intervene, like, hey, I know these individuals, they're not criminals, I can vouch for them, they're fine, leave them alone. Like, oh man, I could totally see her facing some sort of retaliation from those other officers. I think that was Tupac Shakur in the audio clip who said he was told that the New York Police Department, this is the biggest gang in the state, which I would totally co-sign on. But yeah, I could see her facing some big time retaliation for acting like, who does this nigga think she is going to come in here and stop us from going out? And that's why we got this badge in the first place, to be able to go out and harass niggers. And you're going to come in here and interrupt. We will get you. No problem about that. That was going through my mind. Where I thought about that a lot when I heard that segment. Other folks who we have not heard from, if you have commentary, please feel free.
Good evening, everyone. It's Karma. Good evening, guests. Good evening to all the other callers. Well, I happen to think that, you know, if there are people in where you live in your neighborhood that, you know, you were in kindergarten with and you went to camp with, and they want to be police officers in your neighborhood and they are non-white people, especially non-white black people, then I think that's a good thing. And, of course, you know, if they try to do the correct thing, I can say for a fact those people have been retaliated against. Their budgets have been cut. You know, they don't get all the goodies that the other police officers get, and they're mistreated. But then, you know, you can get volunteers. You can get like 30. Actually, we got so many volunteer police officers that the white people say, oh, for the first time in a billion years, we're going to limit how many volunteers you can have. So we have a lot of volunteers. And that's a great thing. And not only that, we have people who say, well, you know, we might as well run for sheriff too, get everybody out. So I'm not against it right now. Like I said, I went to school with these people and I feel pretty comfortable with them being enforcement officers in my community. They routinely say, well, you know, we don't really arrest senior citizens, so we won't be doing that tonight. And we like to protect young people even when they make mistakes, so we won't be doing that tonight either. So I have nothing but good to say for the police officers, the enforcement officials in my area. Next, as far as Mr. Gray is concerned, I remember Dr. Welsing saying that, you know, someone who showed up for the first day of orientation in medical school could look at that video of Mr. Gray and know that he had a C-spine injury before they even put him in the vehicle. So Mr. Gray clearly had an injury before they put him in the vehicle. Dr. Welsing said it. Anyone who just showed up for orientation would know it. And the fact that they are saying that the police officers just wouldn't recognize such an injury is a complete bald-faced lie, because each and every one of them is trained as a first responder. They are trained in CPR. They are trained in basic rescue. They are trained in first aid. And they know exactly what a C-spine injury looks like, and they know how to protect against it. So that was a lie on that part. And besides, when you break someone's neck, it's kind of like when you break a chicken bone, you feel all the ligaments give. It is unmistakable. His murderer felt his neck snap, and anyone around him felt his neck snap when it happened. Next. Oh, that's all right. That would be too inflammatory. But, okay, that's it. Those are the only two I wanted to comment on. Thank you.
My man, Peter Liang, he did say that he got rather poor training with regards to CPR and the medical aspect of being an enforcement official. That was his excuse when he shot and killed a cag early and did not give CPR or any medical attention after killing this unarmed black male. So they might have said the same thing, too. We had, you know, really shabby training, so we were not able to detect that Freddie Gray had any substantial injuries, life-threatening injuries. Other folks that are with us have, that we haven't heard from, have comments, observations they wanted to share?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, greetings, everyone. This is Puff. Just want to make a quick comment and bring up a white pattern that I see, you know, with the commentary that you just played earlier in the broadcast. They're closing a lot of these cases, and, you know, after the hoopla, you know, after the first, it seemed like that's a white pattern where, you know, a person is murdered, and then, I'm sorry, a black person is murdered, and it's obvious, and so they assuage details of that, and then they wait until it's kind of, until the public is occupied with other topics and things that have been going on, and then they quietly resolve those cases. In other words, they close the cases without, you know, and with white impunity. And, you know, there just seems to be a white pattern there. And to me, you know, the 10th area of activity should be the media, in my opinion, because that's the biggest tool the white supremacy, it seems like, because, you know, people all over the world are seeing those images, and you know, and just like, you know, last week with the people that called in, they want to know about, you know, what's going on in America. And unfortunately, it just seems that blacks can't get justice. With the civil rights workers here, that was on the news earlier this week. And what was also been going on in Mississippi is that Jackson's district attorney has been indicted. They trying to get him out of office, look like. And, you know, so, you know, they trying to railroad him from some trumped up charges or whatever. And it seems like they're trying to get him out of office, you know, just trumping up something, you know, to run their agenda. We won't know. It's like my dad says, you know, it's white folks' business. And, you know, we won't ever know, you know, the full, you know, detail of what that is. But it's white folks' business. Is they running their agenda. And somehow their agenda is to get the district attorney that is here in Jackson, they trying to get him out of office and railroad him on some trumped up charges. Maybe they want to put another person in and stuff, because isn't it that I remember seeing something where, you know, with the prison population, like, remember how Mr. Fuller says that, you know, in those rural counties, in white areas, you know, they build prisons, and that's a source of industry for those white towns, and everybody's begging for a prison. But those prisons got to be, I think it's 90% occupancy, and then if they don't arrest so many people, in other words, and have occupancy in those prisons, I think they build a city so much. I don't know how that system works either, but I remember seeing a report on that someone did. And I guess that's why they trying to put more black people in prison. Maybe they fell down on their quote unquote quota, or I don't know. Maybe he didn't have so many convictions. I don't know why they're trying to do this. But again, like my dad says, it's white folks' business. We won't know the total agenda of white supremacy at all. We just, you know, they just do those things and, you know, do chess moves, and we don't really know where they're coming from, really, on what they're doing. And go ahead to the next person.
I know Dr. Cambon has talked about that a lot as well. You were saying, Mr. Fuller, talking about they use the prison system as a means of welfare for whites. I think that's the way Dr. Cambon references it as well, on a regular basis, that provides jobs and really can, much like the plantation era of racism, white supremacy, one and the same, just upgrade, if you will, but the whole town will be built around that prison structure, and keeping these non-white people, mostly black people, in greater confinement. All the other folks that dialed in with a hand up, if we have not heard from you, if you had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Gus, callers and listeners. I'm Douglas. I called in last week about the definition of white and the question of how we should use that term, or even whether we should use that term. I wanted to talk about the Brexit, where Britain is leaving the EU. And I've been following this for some time, and the reason they're leaving the EU, at least from the different European speakers or people who are classified as white, the different speakers that I've listened to, the reason that they're leaving the EU is because of immigration that is not white, or non-white immigration into their area. They're afraid that they're not going to get to remain albino. And so they had a whole lot of complaining, especially around like between 2010 and 2012, a lot of complaining about their birth rate. Their birth rate, the last I heard, they would say that it's at 1.38, which means they're having too few children to replace themselves. They're losing their population numbers. And this is what Dr. Wilson was talking about, the fear of genetic annihilation, is that, you know, eventually there's not going to be any more people who are the group of albinos that came from Europe, from an albino colony in Europe after the last ice age. You know, they're going to cease to exist in the genetic deficient state of albinism. But I wanted to mention that that's the biggest push for the Europeans or the albinos in Britain. The biggest push for them to leave the EU is so that they can remain albino. And Dr. Cambon, to his point, he made a point before that there's one solution. Like there's a solution to this problem, this you know, quote unquote racism or white terror domination, or however you want to define it, you know, albino supremacy, or however you want to define it. I guess my contribution would be, I think that it may be that if we stop using the term white, or at least as we had discussed last week, if we examine the term white, change the definitions. But even I would say you can change the definitions, but also, which I've heard a lot, which is good, incorporating the term or the phrase individuals who classify as white. I think if all the black people did that, we could actually solve this problem, because everything else I see that we could do has already been checkmated, but they don't have any defense against not being white. Like if you stop calling them white, there's no defense against that. Even when I listen to the white supremacists, their different radio stations, they'll say their last defense is the term white, or is that they are white. So I just wanted to make that comment. And I also wanted to say that I think it's a really good job that the Cows Radio does speaking about racism, because it's necessary. I don't know how else we'll defeat it if we don't talk about it. But all right, thank you. I'll leave my line.
I just had two quick questions. One, are there individuals that are not white that are also classified as albino? And then the second question is, how would no longer classifying anybody as white or calling them white, how would that solve the problem of racism, white supremacy, if you had a sizable number of black people or all of the individuals that are black doing that?
Yes, sir. So as you mentioned before, there are albinos or albinos who are not part of the albino colony that came out of Europe. However, what white people, that term is referring to very specifically the individuals, the individual albinos coming out of an albino colony out of Europe, out of the last ice age. That's a group. And then there's other albinos that, you know, just in nature, you know, life makes albinism. So there's a difference, to answer your first question, there's a difference between, you know, people just making albinos, and then there was an albino colony out of Europe. I was told that, I think Britain, or I think it used to be called Albion, which means the land of the albinos. And even they have Albania. So the people who classify as white are, they understand that they're albinos. That's, even I did research over at at a university where I studied albino mice. And we would take the organs out of the mice and do these tests, you know, for diabetes and whatever else. But they understand that they're albino. They do tests on albino mice. That's their creatures. That's to answer the first question. The second question was, well, how is this actually going to solve anything, you know, the race problem especially? I would say a number of reasons. First, in order to have white supremacy, you have to have white people. There has to be white people. And it's not albino supremacy. That doesn't quite work in the minds of anybody. You know, if we were successful of not calling, you know, getting everybody to stop calling them white, and they say, okay, well, we're going to, you know, just go as albino. Because I've actually tried this before, stop calling them white. And they'll say, oh, well, I'm European. And then, you know, and then a couple sentences later, they'll say they're white. But they want to be white. That's the thing. That's the key. They really want to be white. Even Dr. Welsing says, what, the four most important words was in this order: racism, white supremacy, and nigger. It was in one of the broadcasts from the Cows Radio, but white being one of the most important words. And so another thing is, you have to, as far as white is referring to the state of, for Europeans, it's referring to the state of albinism, a genetic deficient disorder, where you can only recreate albinism if you have another albino. You have to have two albinos mating, or, you know, somebody with regular genetics has to have the albinism trait or something like that. So if you stop calling them white, they'll stop wanting to be white. They'll stop wanting to it's like that's actually what helps them to maintain their line of whiteness, is that they're called white. But if you stop calling them white, they lose track somewhat of what they're genetically supposed to do in reproducing whiteness, or reproducing albinism, because it's the state of albinism that's actually giving them their power. I know that it'd be hard to explain in a very short period of time, so I want to close my line. I just wanted to say that. The women make the decision ultimately of whether white people will continue to be reproduced. If the women don't want to be white, then, you know, whether they mix with the, you know, God forbid, they mix with a non-white person, you know, they stop being white, or if they just, you know, choose to not produce a white person, stop producing albino people. That's the option. But it just like, you know, well, I'm not going to use metaphors. But anyway, that's to answer your question directly. There's more evidence that I could use, but that's what I'll say now. Thank you.
Hmm. Okay. I think the first question about are there non-white people that are classified as albino, you did say yes, there are, but you said there's a distinction between those individuals and individuals that are classified as white. Got that. The second question in terms of how would non-white people, or if it's just black people, if they stopped classifying these individuals as white, that would go about solving this problem. That was not, to me, it did not seem logical. I think there's evidence that there have been substantial periods under racism, white supremacy, where non-white people were not calling these individuals white. We didn't even know what language they were speaking. There were difficulties in communication, as they say, and they were still dominating, practicing racism, white supremacy against the people that they said are not white. And I don't see any evidence now if all of us just said, well, we're not going to call them white. We're going to call them something else. Albinos, same thing we're talking about with black. We can make up new terms. I just didn't hear anything logically as to how, to me, it definitely does not make sense that white people would get confused about what they're supposed to be doing on the planet with regards to white supremacy, just on the basis of non-white people no longer calling them white. That, to me, in my brain computer, does not make sense at all in terms of that, how that would confuse these individuals so that they are no longer straight about what they're supposed to be doing on this planet. That, unless some other folks, if they got it, great. But for me, that did not make logical sense. And you did say it's difficult to explain in a short period of time, though. Other folks who had commentary, if you want to comment on what you heard from a previous caller, who chimed in last week. I think he said his name was Doug. I might be in error. I thought he said Douglas. Other folks that we have not heard from, if we missed anybody, if you had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I had a few things I wanted to comment on from both the audio segments and other observations I've ran into or discovered this week. Well, the first from the audio segment about the guy that was talking about the billboards, Make America White Again, like, it was people pointing that out. I noticed a couple of months ago, when it comes to spotting and detecting code words and phrases, like I noticed on one article, one of the people in Britain or England used that in the sign, Make Britain Great Again as well. So that guy had on a hat, I think he was in Tennessee, and it had the, like an acronym, WWFFD, and I had looked it up. I believe it stands for What Would the Founding Fathers Do? And it sounds like it's connected to the Christian anagram, well, not anagram, but acronym, What Would Jesus Do? And I had looked at an interview, and he was basically saying, it sounds like he was basically mentioning genetic annihilation, saying that, well, you know, this county is 98.6 white, and he said the social engineers are trying to use government subsidy and federal housing programs to forcefully integrate this county. He said that in another interview, and he was just basically saying, you know what, when it comes to them being offended, you know, why don't they just get over it, like he said in the clip. And he said, you know, I'm just offended by things, too. He said, the world is offensive. And he was speaking in a lot of cliches, it sounds like, to me. And he wasn't being very specific in regards to the accusations of racism. But it just seemed like he had a concern about, you know, the white collective and how are we going to reproduce, basically. Like, he didn't say that, but that's how I interpreted it. And second, there was a it was a Black Lives Matter protest. It was a little while back, maybe like a month and a half ago. And it's this person who classifies as gay. And like to connect this with the Orlando shooting, like Gus had mentioned, most of the victims are non-white, but they don't seem to really be pointing that out in the media stations, news stations. And there seemed to be this thing with the LGBT trying to take advantage of that, primarily the white LGBT community, and just misusing it for their own racist purposes. This guy, I guess he calls himself a quote-unquote Republican or conservative commentator. He was saying a lot of tacky, trashy things to these Black Lives Matter protesters. They came in and they interrupted an event, and the white people there, they called the police on them. And as they were just demonstrating, like just standing before the stage, this the white guy, he was basically saying, you know, y'all can stand here all you want. You're going to be escorted out by the police. So the police comes in there and, you know, he's saying a bunch of just random things on the microphone saying, you know, you're about to contribute to the minority statistics or the black statistics that they get locked in the penitentiary, you know, just basically going into the stereotypes. And he also said that, I see some of these black women up here, you know, I just think they're just mad because I had sex with their brothers. And then he said it again, and then all of the white people started clapping in the audience. So he was saying a bunch of comments like that. And I forgot what the guy's name was, but I guess he was upset with the university because this was on a campus. So I guess he asked for a refund back for him to make an appearance on some kind of show there. And lastly, there's this guy, I think up in the New York area. He has been, I guess, doing a series of donating, like, I guess, his sperm to helping, I guess, females have babies. And I looked at an article, and most of the pictures, like, they have photographs of the females that had offspring with his DNA or whatever, and these overwhelmingly look like black females. So he's posing on like four or five different pictures. This guy's name is Ari Nagel, like A-R-I-N-A-G-E-L. So he was on an interview, and one of the anchors conducting the interview was a black female. So he was basically saying he has 22 children that he's done this, like going to the sperm donor clinics. So this is, in my opinion, looks like a white person. So as the interview ended, the black female, she asked him something. She says, when will be the next time you're going to donate more sperm? And then he asks her, he says, I don't know, are you ovulating? So yeah, definitely area 8. So yeah, that's pretty much all I had.
Woof, doesn't get any better than trashy. Caller in Michigan, did you have commentary you wanted to add?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners. I just had a question, and I was just wondering if anybody can just give me some feedback. My question was, how do you, as a victim of racism, white supremacy, maintain balance in your life? I find myself just struggling for balance. I have, you know, I'm minimizing contact with a lot of people. My thinking and my thoughts are just totally different from a lot of the people that I typically would associate with. And just things have, you know, just the more and more I become codified, so to speak, my life has just changed tremendously. And I'm just wondering, how do you all maintain balance in your life where you're not getting depressed, where you're not just, I mean, it is a lonely walk, in my opinion. It's pretty sad. but I'm just wondering, how do you all maintain balance? Anything that you all could share, offer, just would be appreciated.
I don't think it's possible. Certainly other people can give their view on this one, but I don't think it's possible. I mean, we're talking about a universe that is catastrophically out of balance because of the system of white supremacy. So I don't think it's possible. I think just recognizing that, I think, number one, I think it becomes even worse. I think things become even more out of balance, unhealthy mentally, spiritually, all the way through. Not recognizing that, acting as though, hey, things are great. We have a system. They have a lot of different ways of articulating it. They'll say we're in a system of democracy, or we're in a system of justice, or, you know, this is great, when that's not what it is at all. This is horrendous. Everything is just totally out of balance, in my opinion. So I think that's one, and I think once you acknowledge that that's what it is as a result of whites, then I think you just try to do the best that you can to compensate. I think that's why Mr. Fuller emphasizes that term so frequently, compensation. You compensate for things being out of balance. I, you know, recommend certainly recognizing when you're having a tough time of things, when you either are feeling depressed, when you're feeling irritated, when you're angry, a combination of all three, when you don't have as much patience as you normally would. Recognizing that and trying to take time for yourself so that you can replenish, so that you can rejuvenate, if it means getting more rest, if it means taking some time away from people and just getting some time to yourself and you can care for self so that you can kind of be feeling a little bit better. But I mean, it is a horrendous situation all the way for, I think, for everybody, particularly the individuals that are classified as black, regardless of, you know, how many resources you might have. It looks like, oh, this person has a great house and a great job and all that stuff. You know, that's irrelevant in the system of white supremacy. I mean, racists are doing a job on all of us, spiritually, emotionally, physically, mentally, our feelings, just everything. So I think just recognizing that and then just trying to do the best that you can to compensate, trying to make sure that you eat quality foods. I know Dr. Rasaya talked about that when he was on the program this week, and in terms of the things that we eat, the things that we put in our mouth, that can go a long way to try to help us compensate for things. But even that can be difficult because of racism, white supremacy. If you even have access to quality nutrition, if you have stores and what have you in your area, if you can afford the material, that sort of thing, they do a great job. And just the general contamination of the entire environment, the entire universe. So in my opinion, that is the battle. I don't think you can have complete balance until the system of white supremacy has been restored. I think that's a part of what Mr. Fuller calls justice, having balance between people, having balance just for yourself. I don't think that would be possible until the system has been eliminated and justice has been established. But you just try to do the best in a compensatory manner until then, unless otherwise I could be in error in my assessment. Did other folks have thoughts, views on that?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, for me, I would say that what helps me the most is regular meditation. I practice Kemetic spirituality, and that's been a big boost for me. Also, I utilize other African traditional religions, namely the Yoruba tradition. I've had visited with Baba Laos and different priests and or priestesses if I needed further insights on certain issues, and that's helped me quite a bit. And to be honest, I think what helped me the most is just better understanding how the system works, because to me, not understanding the system is a handicap, a mental deficiency, and it breeds insanity in the sense that you're not really, like Dr. Wilson says sometimes, not really living in the real world and understanding how it functions. So I think that's helped me the most, is just understanding that I am at war, that white people are predators, and I'm actually prey. So I kind of keep a constant mindset of that understanding at all times. And when I encounter white people, I treat them like the predators they are. I'm not scared of white people, never have been. I'm wary of them. And that just means a high distrust, and that's what I walk with. But as far as what's helped me to kind of alleviate the stress that comes with that, as I would say, definitely meditation's helped quite a bit. And African traditional spirituality has helped me immensely as far as sometimes navigating the system, because you can get insight as far as just understanding things that are to come or how to spiritually navigate some of those things. And then just the ability to alleviate stress. Meditation, especially Kemetic meditation, really has helped me to alleviate a lot of stress on an internal level. So for me personally, that's what I think has helped the most. And like I said, just being honest with myself about what I'm dealing with and not being in a state of fooling myself into thinking that I'm not in the situation that I'm in, or that black people are not in the situation that we're in. To me, that's a great survival mechanism, just because you're dealing with reality for what it is, and you make better decisions based on understanding the reality that you're dealing with. I think the people who tend to suffer the most are the people who somehow believe or convince themselves that they are not in the system of white supremacy, or that racism doesn't exist anymore, or those people who tend to go along to get along. I think there's very high stresses that come with that, in a way that not that you're not going to get stresses if you're dealing with reality. It's just that how you navigate those stressors, I think, is tends to be in a more balanced way if you have that full understanding and you have a spiritual, some sort of spiritual access to kind of balance that stress. That's for me personally. I don't know how that would function for other people, but that's my personal take. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
With me, I have been in this atmosphere for 59 years, and I would say about three quarters of those 59 years, I have generated, I guess what would be considered an unusual amount of attention to the global system of racism, white supremacy. I said unusual, comparable to what most, what I have experienced, most non-white people, non-white black people that I've been around have generated focus on. I have, focused a lot on the subject matter from as honest as I possibly could, in a way that honesty was that I make paramount, whether it's mistakes on my behalf or looking at the global system of racism, white supremacy in the most clarified way that I possibly can. So that basically keeps me in a state of mind of continuation. I spent a great deal of amount of time around a lot of younger non-white black males through the venue of athletics. I've listened to the distaste of a lot of the callers about athletics, and rightfully so, but nevertheless, in the involvement that I'm in, I basically spend a lot of time around. It gives me a chance to spend a great deal of time around non-white black males as coaches, as well as the teenagers that I deal with as much as I want to, actually. I could be calling some of them right now if I wasn't listening to the program, as I do. So those are some things that kind of like, it keeps you generated. It keeps you generated in a constructive manner. And I'm fortunate enough to have other non-white black people who I know personally, that we share views. We do at least those four things that Mr. Fuller mentions about. Well, with myself and others, we do the part of sharing, exchanging views, and sometimes it also would come down to a interaction as far as fixing, repairing, or cleaning something of constructive value. Those things are very important, and it keeps you generated in a constructive manner. And it also keeps everything with clarity and honesty, and you just busy yourself from that standpoint. And as I hear a lot of people say, moving forward, so to speak. And it keeps everything very healthy. Of course, you know, you still are angry. You're darn right, angry about white people and the position that they choose to be in this equation. Yes, but if you bounce it off by, as I mentioned, working, engaging, and at the same time staying focused on the global system of racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works, it kind of like cuts down on the aspects that the caller was concerned about, rightfully so on her behalf. I definitely can understand on where you're coming from on that, but maybe some of those things that I brought up would help you in that light. There are plenty of callers that you could even exchange, leave your whatever means of you choose to try to get in contact with them on, do it. And, that can also be something constructive because, like I said, that's exchanging views. It can go beyond just this program as far as that concern. And that's what I have to say about that. Thank you.
Folks want to respond to the question. That's great. I just want to try to include as we respond to different questions that have been posed that are more open to everybody participating. The other people that are with us that have not shared yet, we can grab you all as we go through the question. All the folks that are with us that have not responded yet, if you have a hand up, feel free. If you wanted to respond to the question from our caller in Michigan, you can do so. And then if you have your own commentary you want to add to that as we go, that's great. Anybody that we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I have a question. The author for the Book of Matt, when is he coming on the program?
That is a really good question. I will have to check my calendar, and I can tell you if you give me like 60 seconds, if you had other commentary, you can give that, and by the time you finish, I should have the date when he'll be on the program.
No, that was my only question because I started reading the book, and I'm almost done. And I'm like, really, really now. I really want to ask him some questions.
Awesome.
Be on the program.
I didn't even start reading it yet. That's great. And I said for people, the book of. The Book of Matt, or the Book of Matthew, whichever it is, but it's the book of Steve Jimenez. That's his name. The book is basically Matthew Shepard. He is the guy. Okay, so he'll be on the program next Sunday. So not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, Sunday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So his book is about Matthew Shepard. That's the white male who. If you've heard when they mention Mr. Byrd, who was killed in Jasper, Texas, the white terrorists, they put a chain around him and drug him behind their truck and then dumped his body in a black cemetery. I think they urinated on his remains, James Byrd Jr. This was 1998, Jasper, Texas. They named the hate crime bill, I think it's called the James Byrd Matthew Shepard hate crime bill. Matthew Shepard is a white male. They say he was gay, and that he died as a result of a hate crime, much like in Orlando. The author that's coming on next Sunday, July 3rd, Steve Jimenez, his book, basically the thesis, even though I'm saying I haven't read it, but I call it, she said she read it. I think she can check me if I'm talking crazy, if I'm lying to you. I think the premise of his book is that this was not a hate crime, that basically this was a drug deal gone bad, and that we have been misinformed, thinking that he died because he was gay. Is that accurate to what you read?
That sums it up. He was a meth dealer, the Matthew Shepard guy, and the guy that supposedly killed him, he was bisexual, and he was a partner of Matthew Shepard. So it was definitely not a hate crime because he was a homosexual.
That's
basically what the book is saying. Hmm. And that the Matthew Shepard guy was basically wrapped up in, you know, criminal activity, and that he was used as a poster boy for the gay movement.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? Yeah, in the book several times, they kept on referring to the Matthew Shepard guy as their Emmett Till.
Wow.
At one point, I think he had quoted Clinton as saying that he compared the killing of Matthew Shepard to a genocide.
Wow.
Yeah. So I have a lot of questions for this white, because I think he's a white male that wrote the book. Because his name is Jimenez.
Yes,
but
ma'am.
I think he's a white male. So yeah, I'm really psyched about having him on the program. So thank you for the information.
Mm-hmm. July 3rd. I kind of slagged a little bit in. Slacked a little bit in getting him on the program because I heard, like, that book has been out for a couple of years. When I heard it, I was like, whoa, that is crazy. And I got it, and I mentioned it on the program, and then I just, you know, I was not on my counter-racist grind saying get to it, but time is right and exact, because that'll be great to discuss that in context with the Orlando shooting, because that could be twice that we've had two of these events that they have really used to heavily promote this mythology that there's some war on gays, and this might be two major incidents where that is not the case at all once you do a little bit more digging, which, again, it might just show the awesome power of the white division of the gay rights army. And particularly with Matthew Shepard, if people remember Jason Collins, this is the black male. He came out, he's recognized the first openly gay person to play in the NBA. He wore number 98, and that was for Matthew Shepard. Like, he did this in interviews and saying, yep, this is for Matthew Shepard, that's my guy, and what happened to him, and blah, 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 and all this, like, anyway.
And I'm sorry, and the Matthew Shepard guy, too, he also had a black boyfriend at one point.
Mm.
Yeah, he also had a black boyfriend. Yep.
Right on. If other folks want to read that in prep for July 3rd, that'll be grand. We can all read it together and prepare for the program. Was there another female caller that was going to comment?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I wanted to touch back to the other caller that was talking about the albinos, I guess, white people in Europe. I was, as he was explaining the situation and I guess was saying about, differentiating the word, using the word white to albino, I was thinking more or less. At the end of the day, for white people, they understand that the term white has currency and value. So it doesn't matter if you change the word, it's what they hold or place value on that word. So, you could change the word the description or classification of people of European descent or whatnot, but they're still going to have a value. Whatever word you choose, it's just a matter of them placing a value on that word. And to the other caller that was talking about things to do to deal with, whether it be depression or just dealing and coping with, the isolation of, just having to deal with racism and stuff and knowing what you know, I would say for me, for the past about a month and a half now, I've been amassing a lot of art supplies. I found a local art store that has some really good quality art stuff and supplies and stuff and drafting tools. So I'm in the works of working on stuff like that. I was initially hesitant in buying a lot of stuff because primarily I'm not trying to stay here in New Orleans. I'm, from Orlando, so I'm ready to go home. But just to get my mind off of things, and I know how, you know, back then, you know, when I was really, really involved with art, I mean, I pretty much didn't have a social life, but that was okay. I was still happy because I was just in my own little world. But I would just say, I mean, just get into, if you got a hobby or something that you're passionate about, like I said, it's kind of, it's a touch and go thing because, like I said, it's, I don't know. I have my good days and bad days, but it's a struggle.
For sure. All of, I think I can definitely agree on that one as well. I think we all under this system have our good days and bad days, and racists, their success, we have many more bad days than good days. That is what this is all about, producing for non-white people, particularly black people. Anybody, all the other folks that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up, did you have commentary, if you wanted to respond to any of the, anything that you've heard thus far, questions that have been posed, suggestions, if you just had your own commentary you wanted to add, that is fine as well. Anyone we haven't heard from?
Go ahead.
It's Lady in New York. I actually had a comment. It was off topic, but I do agree with the previous caller when she was stating that she was getting involved in hobbies and getting things from art supply stores to help with stress. I've actually been working on that daily myself for about maybe 2 months, and it has definitely helped. So I just wanted to kind of discuss some current events that were on that. And one was very interesting. We had a gentleman by the name of Cordell Jackson, and he's in Henrietta. And he had a store, two gun stores, and he's a black gentleman. And so it's been all around over the news and in the newspaper, and how they have recently, how they closed this gun shop, and pretty much seems like they're kind of terrorizing the gentleman. And he's the first one in New York to get criminal charges brought against him as far as gun shop owners with violating the New York Safe Act. And I'm like, of course it would be the black gentleman to be the first one to get charged. And I was very surprised that when I first heard that a black man had two gun shops, I was like, I was in disbelief. I was like, that's got to be, like, he's got to be a partner with somebody. It cannot. White people are not letting him have these commercials on TV and on the radio, and then he's showing his black face, that he's this gun shop owner. And I just think they were very crafty, and they got him, and they took his business. And now he's facing some jail time. I mean, when they have been, they posted like 3 days different, 3 or 4 days different stories that were so confusing about why they closed this gentleman's two gun stores. The numbers of guns that supposedly were unaccounted for and things that he did wrong changed every day. So where his lawyer stated that because
of how complex the paperwork is that no one, no gun owner, doesn't have a mistake somewhere and that doesn't understand why his client's being charged. And even went into that law enforcement were going to his customers' homes and inspecting, quote unquote, the guns that they had purchased from Cordell Jackson. And again, the attorney states, you know, now he's in jeopardy of jail time, but we've actually resolved most of these issues. So why is he going to court or facing criminal charges for most of these issues? And that the way that the new law has been written, it kind of makes it pretty difficult for him to stay in business. So I just immediately thought, wow, they have finally did it. When I first saw him at his commercials, that it was actually a black man who owned these two gun shops, I said, well, when are they going to do it? And they have finally found a way to get him, his employees, and some of his customers with criminal charges because, you know, black people cannot own gun shops and have access to that amount of weapons. So that was just something that I thought was interesting to see how, you know, the racist white supremacists are at work here in New York. And so I will mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just have a question. I read on Facebook and hear from my friends that black people are going to feel serious repercussions as a result of this United Kingdom thing when it all comes down. And they're saying that we think things are bad now, but things are going to get much worse. Could you or someone tell me about what those repercussions might be or how things could get worse for us?
Most of the reports that I have seen right now, they're saying that it's going to take some time to kind of figure out how all of this is going to look in the future as they exit. It's not like they're leaving on Monday. I think they're trying to put a plan together for when they formally exit the EU. This is supposed to take, you know, a bit of time of getting done. Some of what I've seen thus far is in terms of economic ramifications, that this had a bad effect on the economy. They were saying that the stock market took a big plunge on Friday, and it impacted impacted markets around the world. So economically, I could see it having a big impact. It's the sort of thing I would have to see more details in terms of how. Folks, again, if you could use your mute button, if you know you are in a loud environment or what have you, if you're not talking, that would be great. But yeah, I would have to see more in terms of how all of this is going to unfold over the course of the end of the year and then on into next year and what have you. David Cameron, the prime minister in Britain, is supposed to be stepping down, so that means they're going to have someone else taking that spot. That's going to be huge, and the election here, it's kind of a lot. It's uncertain right now, so I would need more information to kind of see how this is all going to evolve in terms of the ramifications that it'll have on black people here in the States. Did they give any detail when they gave this forecast that things were going to be getting worse?
No, They didn't give any detail. But I assume it's economic driven. I mean, you're very smart, and I figure you might, since you keep up with a lot of the stuff. With that. But that's all I have to say. Thank you.
For sure. That'll be something to keep an eye on. Is that you, Puff?
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. But,
it's good. Go ahead.
I had a, you know how you say you have a Wesson moment? Well, I had a Fuller moment this week. I don't have Facebook, but, like, they said that, like, I heard somewhere on YouTube or something, somebody said they have 22 genders to choose from on Facebook. Is that true?
I know it was being reported. I do have Facebook. I haven't checked, but I know within the last years they've been making the LGBT gay rights movement, as they have continued to get more victories, quote-unquote, and be more successful. I have seen that reported, that I think Facebook and some of the other more popular social media outlets, that they were having, you know, lots and lots of gender settings, that some of them even had more than that. I think it was one where they had 50 different options for gender, and this was something to be a milestone to be celebrated. So I would not doubt it, even though I haven't checked it to make sure.
Wow. And, you know, speaking of LGBT situation, I know you have the bail for interracial. When interracial is being discussed, I was wondering if you could formulate a sound effect for the LGBT when they try to sneak that in under the radar, or one of your guests or something. Maybe you could have a sound effect for that. Maybe.
That's a good idea. I have to think on that. Something related to the program. I'll have to think about that. But yeah, that is a good suggestion. I'll just give me a little time to think on it, and I'll see if I can come up with something.
Lucky charm.
Other folks that we had not heard from, we certainly had questions on the table. If people have thoughts, I'm trying to make sure I get all the people that we have not heard from. Anybody, if we have not heard from you at all, you should speak now, and then we can get anybody else if you want to respond to some, any of the questions that have been put forward.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. It's me again. No, I also
Hang on. I'm just trying to make sure I didn't miss anybody, and then we'll be sure to get you in, Princess. I'm just trying to make sure I didn't miss anybody so I don't get fussed at. Because I get in trouble if I miss folks. They get rather nasty in the emails. Anybody that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up and we have not heard from you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I have a few things I wanted to say. One regarding, I was watching New York One, a news channel here in New York City. And they had a interesting debate. It was for Charles Mingus' open seat in the U.S. Senate, or in Congress, I mean. And there was, you know, a white guy. It was Colin Powell, the third or fourth. It was, you know, a couple of black people who's been here for 20, 30 years, you know. And in particular, a couple of Dominicans from the Washington Heights area who have a lot of political power. One, Espinar, who was ran against Ringel the last time Ringel got elected. And it was a very racially polarized election. You know, it was like they kind of split the vote. Ringel got the black, Espinar got the Dominican, and the Puerto Ricans were the deciding. And being that the Puerto Ricans and Dominicans don't get along, they went with Ringel, and Ringel won. But it was just a lot of the talking points during this debate, I thought, were very interesting. As far as they all were in agreement, they want to shut down Bikers Island and do away with a lot of the drug charges, a lot of indications of the Rockefeller drug lords and things. So it was just a very interesting debate. Unfortunately, I got a chance to watch something else. I was talking to my wife Monday, and she was watching TV, and, you know, it was a scene that came on, Love and Hip Hop, and a gentleman was caught with 10 pounds of marijuana, and he faced the judge, And the charge carried the time of 5 years to 30 years. And, you know, he gave his little speech saying, you know, he apologizes for the crime and, you know, willing to pay the restitution, and he's a good father and a part of his kid's life. He wanted the judge to be lenient, so the white judge says, I'll be lenient. He turned around and gave him 20 years. Just thought about, man, the power of these people, man. They have so much power. As for the question, I would say to the question about you're a black person and you become more aware, and it's difficult to be in the same social settings with people who you've always been in social settings with because they're not seeing the problem. I would say that you would have to either eliminate those people as your friends or, you know, socialize with them in a way that is not, you know, being a counter-racist, because they're not going to get it. And being that it's you giving it to them, they're definitely not going to get it. You know, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of white people that's going to tell them what to say, you know, that's going to say what we're saying, and they're going to just automatically take that as the almighty, you know, word. You know, it's coming from another victim like them. So, you know, of course, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. What I found is over the years, I've left a lot of people over that I was friends with, and they didn't get it, and it was very difficult to be aware and dealing with people who weren't in certain social settings. So I wouldn't hang out with those people. And I would say mostly all of those people have come back to me over the years when something happened. With, you know, you said, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. So those people will come back eventually and say that, you know, I what I try to do to my friends and things is, hey, you know, they're my friends, I love them, but I still gonna talk the way I talk. If they're gonna say I'm crazy or whatever, y'all can say what y'all want to say. I know I'm right. You know, you can't tell me I'm not right. And without a doubt, you know, every one of them has come back. You know, I get a call, you know, 2 a.m, hey, man, you know, that guy I worked with, you know, the white guy, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it never fails. So, you know, just know that you're doing the right thing. You're on the right path. What I find very comforting is the ability, you know, I was listening to the cows and I started emailing Gus, and just sometimes, you know, seeing things and able to send that email to Gus, and also I email Vaz a lot, and, you know, we correspond, you know, and that kind of lets me know there's other people out there who see it, and I know that I'm right, and the people who are around me who I love, I know that they're wrong. But, you know, it's just going to take time for them to see it. But without a doubt, I guarantee they will. And, you know, that's all I can say.
Anybody that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up and we have not heard from you at all, you should speak now. Anybody that had a hand up that we missed, hadn't been able to speak at all? Okay, I will assume that we got everybody who dialed in who has a hand up. I'm not entirely sure. Out of the people that dialed in later in the program, I'm not completely sure, but if I did not get you, you should just go ahead and speak up. But I think everybody, if you dialed in and you have a hand up, your line should be open. Princess, were you going to comment?
Yeah, I was going to say that probably been about a week now since my Facebook page was attacked. And then when I tried to do another page, of course, they took that down too. So I've just concluded, like, I had heard the program from last Sunday that you know, this whole gay rights thing is just gonna, they're pretty much just trying to keep gay and black together, gay and black, black and gay together, at all times. Because now it's just, I had a few individuals, one of which was a black male who happened to be gay, and then another one was a non-white, non-black, who I pretty much would say identified as white, though, gay male back home in Florida. And I suspect he was the one that reported my page when I posted a series of clips. And I had the same issue years back when I was on YouTube, but I don't know. So I'm pretty much, I'm not sure whether or not I'm even going to attempt to continue on going back and forth with Facebook, because they were asking me about giving them my ID and stuff. And at the same time, I didn't know that my, this all happened while my sister had a layover in Turkey. And I didn't find out until later on, so my dad was calling because she was just coming from her trip from Ghana, because she attended her best friend's wedding over there. So she had a layover in Turkey when all this was going on. So I'm paranoid, like, okay, you know, was really up. And like I said, my dad works for the government, so I'm just like, oh, shit. So, oh, I'm sorry. But, but yeah, I don't know.
I'm not surprised, and I had said that at some point in the last week or two since the shooting in Orlando, that is my perception, because that's what it's been for a while now. But if you are a black person and you are talking in any way as though you are not, you know, 1,000% in support of LGBT rights, gay rights, all of that, if you even remotely sound as though you have some questions about that or not into all of that, oh man, you will be under attack. You're already under attack under the system of white supremacy, but that's been a big part of it. As you said, keeping gay and black together, and then also going after black people and saying that we are the greatest homophobes, and any black person that seems like you might not be completely in support of all that they are promoting with gay rights and LGBT this. I did just look at Facebook since the program has been on. You can change your gender on Facebook, but they have male, female, and then custom. So if you do not want to select male or female, then you can write whatever you want for your own gender identity. They don't have like 50 different terms or anything, labels under the gender option, but you can change it to whatever you want specifically. You can just write it in the box, so I guess that's, you know, open-ended. Other folks, go ahead.
I was gonna say, but what if I mean, because basically now they're saying that they require you to provide your date of birth and a current photo of you or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm looking at it, and then, like, when I was trying to, when you Google my original page up under my name, they first started off by saying that I was a Princess Rodman when they took down my original page. So I was just like, I've been operating with this, with my name since, you know, Facebook has, you know, been up, and, you know, I don't know what this is about. So I just ignored it for the time being. One of my colleagues was just telling me, just start a different page, but they're saying that you can't have two. So I used another name, and then I think I had shared some clips or articles that I had previously posted. I was only able to find about two or three, and one of them apparently was flagged, because it was talking about interracial dating or something. So I had changed it up a little bit, and it let me post it. But then I think I was friending a couple of other colleagues, you know, who are counter-racist, and then that's when it came out and said that I had to show my government ID with my name and all this other stuff, and I was just like, no. But I'll try that. I'll try it.
Platforms definitely not were they were not constructed for us. I'm reminded there have been many reports over the years that enforcement agencies, the FBI and such, that they just use all these platforms for data mining. So I just keep all that in mind to begin with in terms of usage of these sites. I know Dr. Campbell, and I did speak with him this week. I know the folks that asked about that. I spoke with him this week, and he authorized, he gave a segment because I wanted to get his thoughts on Dr. Welsing as well as, you know, some of the other things that have been happening. But I was especially excited or just eager to hear his thoughts on the significance of Dr. Welsing and the way she invested her time and energy. So I'll play that sometime over the next week. We have a spare moment, but I did talk to him on Wednesday, but his recommendation remained. He wouldn't encourage having a Facebook page at all because it'll probably just be used against you at some point, whether it's employment or whatever else when racists have the opportunity. One of our listeners wrote in response to the question, or really more in response to Thomas in New York. He was talking about the black person that ended up getting a lot of jail time, the amount of power that whites exercise over our lives. I was reminded of Richard Pryor, where he does a comedy routine talking about he himself when he was going to court and just realizing the awesome power that whites wield over our lives. And he was just dropping, bam, 40 years, bam, 25 years, bam. He was just dropping it like he was, you know, just putting down a piece of paper for what he was going to order for lunch or something, you know, just really trivial. And this is, bam, 4 decades, bam, 3 decades. And he said, the listener wrote in, he said what Thomas just stated reminded me of the 30 for 30 documentary on Allen Iverson, in which he stated that white MF has a lot of power. On a lighter note, once he was acquitted, he stated, "Let's go to the mall." Classic moment. I played that audio segment on the program a few times. That is a legendary, that's not the most recent one. I know they just did a newer documentary on Allen Iverson. This is not that one. This is a different one, the ESPN 30 for 30, which came out a few years ago, which is phenomenal. I would definitely encourage folks because it's pretty much all about racism. Anybody else, particularly if we have not heard from you, you should speak up now. If we got everybody who had a hand up, that's great, spectacular. If anybody else had anything they want to comment, but if we have not heard from you, you should speak right now.
Hey, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, Gus?
Yes, sir.
In reference to what Puff brought up about Facebook and their 50 gender classifications, I was listening to Dark Matter Radio on Black Talk, hosted by Ronnie McLean, and he talked about New York State itself having 46 different gender classifications. I don't know where all this stuff is coming from, but I mean, it just, I don't know if, because since I was a young child, I've always loved wildlife documentaries, and I've watched, studied animals and all kinds of stuff my whole life. And I just find it so interesting that humans are the only living animal on this planet that has or is perpetuating a non-productive cycle of so-called sexuality as a viable sexual orientation. And there's no other living thing on the planet that does that. It's either you're one gender or another, or if you're asexual or whatever the case may be as far as just wildlife itself. But human beings are the only living creature that are going through this, like, extremely widespread concept of self-destructive sexual activity as a normalized functional behavior. And to me, that in and of itself just speaks volumes to the fact that, you know, and in my opinion, I go along with Dr. Umar, it is a mental illness. You cannot
you know, be engaged in something that does not perpetuate the cycle of life that is unnatural, and try to make that natural, because that's just not how nature functions. And white people, I think, have done the most incredible job at completely altering the psychosexual understanding of all other human beings, and they have finally gotten enough a critical mass to go along with this. And again, it has nothing to do with people who are, you know, LGBTQ, you know, DGQ. You do whatever you feel is necessary. If that's what you're into, that's fine. But to try and perpetuate it as a natural form and functional behavior when it actually is an illness, there's nothing natural about it. Just to me, it just speaks volumes to the great job that white people have done, and I think it's going to get a lot worse in the years to come. Thank you.
Absolutely. Contempt for gender, as Mr. Fuller calls it. Contempt for gender. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to make a comment to what the last caller said. I think that with whatever this agenda is, there will be documentaries saying the exact opposite, you know, that animals in the wild engage in this behavior all the time, and it's very productive for them to do such. And it, if they're, you know, animals that are kind of like in some type of herd or you know, not lonely animals, you know, that it's good for them, and their fellow animals are fellow, I don't know, lions have pride, it's good for the whole pride. Because I saw a couple times on YouTube where there were clips saying, you know, that this animal is engaging in same-sex activities, and this is how they get to know each other. And then you'll find on YouTube someone who actually, that's their field of study, that's their specialty, who says, no, that's a sign of aggression, and it's not a good thing. But give it some time, and it'll, you know, you'll have these documentaries saying, yeah, this is good for the animals, great for their life cycle. And, you know, all animals do this. So, that was just the comment that I wanted to make on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hey, Gus, can I touch on something? Because she made me think of something in reference to what she discussed, which I think is very true and very profound. I was thinking, because one thing I think when they do start to come up with those things, because they've been saying this for a little while now, I believe it was Tim Don't Drink the Kool-Aid Wise, who's also made references to the same thing. And what they'll never talk about is the origin of that, because none of these discussions about so-called homosexual animals ever came to fruition until this big push for homosexuality to be normalized. And I remember I saw a documentary a few years back on silverback gorillas in the Congo, and the fact that homosexual activity took place in the Congo amongst silverback gorillas and was first documented after the Civil War in the Congo, in which so many of them were killed, and specifically the females were killed off in such drastic numbers that the males, some of them, started to take on a homosexual behavior towards the younger males because there were no females for them to mate with, which is akin to when black males and other non-white males are placed in prison in situations where they have no access to females, that they also will start to partake of this sort of behavior. So what white people will never speak about is the psychocultural conditioning that they've put out there, also the chemicals they put in the food and in the water and in all other things to create this sort of situation, not just with wildlife, but with people, just with children who take certain drugs, and they contract something called gynecomastia, in which males will grow breasts and hips and have fatty buttocks and things of that nature. These are all things that they will not discuss, and it reminds me of an old episode of The Cows. I believe it was 909 had talked about something called, a book called The Quarrel, and it was about the philosophy of poetry And I forget the full title. We hope he's listening. But that book really, he discussed it on the show many years ago about how it speaks about white people. He talked about the Romans and other groups that when they took over other nations, one of the first things they would do is instate homosexuality as acts of terror. They would just wholesale rape the males in the society and things of that nature to basically psychosocially condition entire societies to accept homosexuality as a natural form of behavior. And they also used it as a means of brutalizing psychologically and terrorizing the males to, again, give them the understanding that they had no control over their own bodies. So this is this type of information that I think will be hidden as we move forward and they get more sophisticated in their refinement of racism, white supremacy in the form of perpetuating homosexual behavior. Thank you.
Yep. Lots to process as we move forward. Certainly will be more to discuss with that. All of the gender confusion, sexual confusion, more to discuss on that. As we move forward, we pretty much did hour three. We should be back tomorrow, as I said, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. We'll have our guest joining us live from South Africa to talk about some of the issues. Might be interesting to hear some of her thoughts on those issues because they are being discussed worldwide on the continent as well. And it's been my experience. It's been the same MO that they use here, where if we're going to talk about white supremacy, racism, we got to include everything else, including gay rights, LGBT, all of that. So we'll bring that up with our guest tomorrow to see how that global patterns with all of this. If you have questions, if you can't find something in the archives, if you have a guest suggestion, complaints, gripes, you feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. I meant to make a request. If any of the folks... if you can recall, or if you have the time to invest, if you're looking for something to do the early part of your summer, if you're sitting out at the beach or outside chilling, maybe you're going camping or what have you, and you want to listen to some Cal's archives, if you can locate the specific episode where Mr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing, because I know each of them, referenced Darth Vader from Star Wars on the program, I just cannot... pinpoint the exact programs, the two respective programs where each of them talked about Darth Vader specifically. I don't think they went into any detail about Star Wars. Well, actually, anyway, Darth Vader was the general focus of it. If you all can pinpoint specific episodes where that took place, that would be grand. If you have any free time or if you just remember which episodes where that happened, that would be great. I was going to try to splice those together. It's something that come to mind, but I just couldn't pinpoint the exact episodes at this point. Thank you kindly. You can email that as well, untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. James Byrd Jr. was mentioned earlier. Unfortunately, I think he was intoxicated the night that he unfortunately rendezvoused with his eventual white killers in Jasper, Texas, 1998, which is, again, one of the worst combinations in the universe. Whites and alcohol. Deadly, can be lethal, frequently is for non-white people, especially black people. If you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, you do not want to be under the influence, especially if you're going to be a driver, even as a passenger or a pedestrian. You do not want to be, put yourself in a position where you can be easily terrorized. You never know when it's going to be Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw. Those are the ones that are pulling you over. They can take your life. Even just having you in greater confinement where you got to spend all this money and time and energy just for something that is easily avoidable. Just being sober. If you got to consume whatever, be codified about that. Get to one spot and stay there. Let's just do everything we can to minimize contact with enforcement officials. Even you don't even want to be under the influence and have to have contact with a white individual at all. They can be lethal. It can be major problems and it can happen quick. We want to be able to make phenomenal decisions under the system of racism.
Excuse me, Gus, I had a quick question.
Man, that interrupting stuff is nerve-wracking. What's your question, sir?
I'm sorry. I had a quick question for you. Yes, sir. Sorry about that. I wanted to ask if you heard about, or if you saw the article I sent you about this information coming out of Michael Jackson's porn collection, child porn collection. They say it's supposedly vast. And also that Tavis Smiley has gotten together, I believe, with a white male to do a comic book on the end stages of Michael Jackson's life. This just also came out earlier this week. I just wanted to know if you heard about that. Sorry for interjecting.
The child pornography aspect I did hear, I was almost going to play that. But then as I checked more of it, the source seemed a little less credible. And I don't mind, you know, playing stuff and then just add that to it as we go. But I didn't even want to. I didn't even want to devote that attention to it. Like I would have been cool with any of you all bringing it up. You wanted to talk about it. That's great because I did see it. But that was just the reason that I didn't play it. But I did see it, and when I say it was not credible, it was the source. I'm just not remembering the source. I guess that broke this or was one of the leading ones talking about that. Talking about this week, they said that they had spliced in some of these appear to be important word. They appear to be police records. Back from the investigation, I guess that would be a decade or so ago, into all of this. And then within these documents that appear to be police records, there's internet information that they just got for, or wherever they got this information from, that's interspersed in between that. So if you're looking at it, you might get the impression that all of this is, you know, a part of an official police investigation, but that's not what it is. That right there was huge for me, because whites are just, they're masterful at this sort of thing, and particularly for someone who's deceased, he can't adequately defend himself. He's already gone to court for this and was exonerated, and now that he's dead, we're gonna come and bring all this up again. And I just a masterful job, now that all of these really, really iconic black figures have transitioned this year. They have just done a really awesome, as Dr. Welsing would say, A pluses across the board. In turn, Prince was just a no-count drug fiend addict, and he may have had HIV, and Michael Jackson was a, you know, child pornographer, and I mean, just masterful job with all of these folks. But I did see that, and I just didn't play the audio clip because it just, the deception seemed more glaring. It only took me about 5 minutes of looking to see a lot of very questionable things in the reporting, so that was why I didn't play it, but I did see it, and would have been cool if we had brought it up earlier in the program.
Let me say thanks for answering. And did you hear about Tavis Smiley at all, or no? And what he was doing, I saw that on the news as well.
The Tavis Smiley comic book aspect, that I did not see.
Okay, I did see that on the news, and they just put out something saying that they have footage of Michael Jackson speaking disparagingly about Prince during the making of his documentary Moonwalker. They said they have footage that was left on the cutting room floor where he talks about his competition with Prince and supposedly makes fun of him for an accident he had during a show a number of years back.
Standard operating procedure. Wait until both of them are dead and now we can get a spat between two black people that are now deceased. That sounds pretty standard and tacky. And I'm not attributing that to Tavis Smiley. That sounds like exactly what I would expect from racist man, racist woman, racist child. Exact sort of thing to do, to have, gotta have black people bickering, squabbling with one another, even if we can get dead black people bickering and squabbling. A pluses again for Dr. Welsing. Dr. Welsing would say A pluses again for Team White Supremacy. Certainly, we will make time. Folks want to bring those, any of those subjects up, topics up, as we move forward from this week. It was a lot that happened this week. We, again, will be here about 12 hours. If you have other questions, gripes, guest suggestions, email untiljustice@gmail.com. Facebook, you can message there as well. We're on Twitter @UntilJustice. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.